Now that Justin's ready, and Randall's here, and I wanted to let you guys know, you guys really look sharp. There, I tell you what, you know, it's kind of a one-sided kind of room, isn't it? Well, okay.
Lucky I didn't grab
be careful, I'll take it.
You weren't talking to Justin.
We want to welcome everybody here tonight. We're just about 3 minutes behind schedule, but we appreciate everybody being here tonight and for the Northeastern RAC meeting. I don't see any Wildlife Board members here. I'm not sure if Dr. Woodward's going to be able to make it or not. I haven't heard from him, and I didn't try to call him. Let's go through and recognize our RAC members. Tim, let's start with you on the end and tell us who you are and what you represent.
Tim Ignacio, Ute Indian Tribe.
I'm Rebecca Jones. I represent non-consumptive users.
I'm Brett Prevedella. I'm public at large.
Randy Durth, sportsman.
Boyd Blackwell, Division of Wildlife.
Richie Anderson, agriculture.
Dan Abeda, the Ashley National Forest.
Andrea Merrill, non-consumptive.
Daniel Davis, sportsman.
Thank you. We have a about a 5 action items tonight, but just kind of tell you what our format is. If this might be your first time, we'll have a period where the division will provide us the topic on the agenda that we're going to discuss and how we they'd like to see us address it. Period by the those attending and the visitors tonight. And then after that, after the questions, there'll be comments. And if you want to make a comment, please fill out one of these cards and get it over here to one of these three lovely ladies, and they'll get it to us. But during the question period, we don't want comments. That's just a question period where we have a chance to really address things that we don't fully understand. But then provide us comments if you want to give a comment. We'd love to have you fill out one of these cards and listen to your comments, and then we'll turn it back to the RAC for discussions and a vote on it. So that's the format we'll run with tonight. And we'll start with we need to approve the last meeting minutes. Everybody had a chance to look at the last meeting minutes. Changes are needed to the minutes? If not, I'll entertain a motion to accept those.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and make that motion that we accept the minutes from last month's meeting.
That was Dan Abeda made that motion. I have a second.
I'll second it.
Andrea Mill made that second. All in favor?
No. And Natasha.
Oh, I'm sorry.
She's here.
Oh, Tosh, wrong hand.
We know it's bad.
All right, Natasha made that second. All in favor? Andrew's in favor too. Thank you. It's unanimous. Next, we need to approve the agenda for tonight. So let's talk about that. Is there any modifications needed to the agenda, or can we make a motion to approve that?
I'll make a motion we approve the agenda as proposed.
Brett Prevedell made a motion to approve the agenda as proposed. Do I have a second? Yeah, Wildlife Board meeting update. There were several topics, as you recall, of our last meeting. One of them had to do with we had made a motion for the bighorn sheep tags on the Wasatch Nebo unit to modify it from 3 to 2, and that's the way the division went. Also, that was passed 5-0. As you remember, there was a motion to decrease the South Manti deer permits from 250 to 200. The board agreed with this, and they passed that 5-0 also. And there was also a motion to keep Pine Valley same as last year, and they passed that 5-0. On the Book Cliffs, lower the additional deer permits from 335 to 15. Okay, help me with that one. I've got it written down. lower the additional deer permits from 35 to 15. I got that showed past 5 to 0. Yeah.
Yeah, it was by 15. So it was by 35 or 15.
All right, and that did pass. And the balance of the deer was passed 4 to 1 with 4 in favor, 1 opposed. That was all the notes. Let's see, I got one more here. Oh, the division accepted the 2018 antlerless deer permits, and that passed unanimously, 5-0. And then the topic of 2018 CWMU antlerless permit recommendations, that passed unanimously also, 5-0. I'll turn the time over to Boyd for the wildlife regional update.
For all those that have noticed the appropriate credit card hits on your credit cards, congratulations are in order. And so everybody run home and check their statements or see what's going on.
They're hitting early.
I want to express appreciation. Last time we met, I talked a little bit about a case that Eric Miller had been working on, and it's a really big convoluted case. It's been in the news a lot around here lately. I want to congratulate him again on his efforts. He did a really good job on putting that case together. There was a lot of work that had to be done, and it hit some folks that were killing a lot of our wildlife here in the basin. And again, I want to tell him I appreciate him. He's not here, but he'll know. As far as the rest of the regional updates, I'm going to let two of my best the wildlife manager and habitat managers are going to give the updates for the region. And with that, I'll turn the time back to you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's do the wildlife projects update. Justin Shannon, he's our wildlife section chief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Justin Shannon. I'm the wildlife section chief, and tonight I'm going to give a presentation. What's that? Okay. Tonight I'm going to give a presentation on wildlife habitats and projects that we've been doing. This is just an informational. It won't be no action taken by the board, but we hope you find some value in it. The purpose of this presentation is twofold. The first is recently our wildlife board asked us to share an overview of how conservation and expo permit funds benefit wildlife and habitat, and we've done really good work in both of these areas with wildlife management and monitoring and habitat work, but we haven't done a great job of highlighting our successes. And I remember sitting on the statewide deer plan and the statewide elk plan, and Dan, you were part of that. We talked about certainly we had areas to improve in both of those plans, but we also had areas that were doing really well. And Some of the feedback we got from those committees were you need to do a better job of outing the good things that your agency does. And so that's kind of what tonight is about. Looking at some big game captures and transplants, over the past 5 years or so, we've captured 74 bison. A lot of that taking place on the Henrys and the Bookcliffs to monitor populations, to do blood, draw blood from these animals for disease and health assessments. That's been really good. We've translocated 124 mountain goats and started some new populations along the way. And on the Parker Mountain, we've captured over 300 pronghorn and translocated 237 of them, some of which came to the northeast region. If you look at bighorn sheep, we've been really busy in this arena. We've captured 779 animals translocated 421 throughout the state over the last 5 years. And the rest of them, we've been monitoring them for movements and building disease profiles and different things like that to really better understand our bighorn populations. With moose, we've captured 174. A lot of these have been on Derek's unit, the Wasatch, which I heard you made a comment about the
question.
Okay, that's really good. That's exciting. So that's been great. And then even on the UNs as well, we've learned more about our moose populations with these captures than we have previously, and it's been great. Elk, down in the bottom left, that's a photo of Kent Hersey, our big game projects coordinator, and he has a machine there called an ultrasound machine, and this is really neat. It's more than just putting a radio collar on an animal and seeing where it goes and how it survives. We can do body condition scores, and you look at the ranching community, they've looked at stuff like this for a long time, and this is catching on in wildlife, and it's really important to know the condition of wildlife because that influences how well they're going to survive, especially hard winters, or how much offspring they're going to have and how populations are going to perform. And then finally with deer, we've trapped almost 4,000 deer in the state over the last 5 years. With our urban deer transplants, we've translocated over 1,300, and it's been a great success. If you look at the research we've done, I won't play all these things, but Wasatch Elk there in the far left, this is a study that BYU's been carrying out with us, and it completely changed the way we manage elk in the state based on the results of this study, where we found that during light, when you have light hunting pressure, those elk will stay on public land, and the minute you start hunting them, they move and congregate on private land. And that's tough. That's tough for sportsmen that want to harvest an elk, and it's tough for private landowners that in many cases don't want that many elk on their property. And so we've tried to come up with tools like private lands only to permits and different things like that to help private landowners alleviate some of those issues, and it's been helpful, especially here in the Northeast region. Monroe Fawn Survival Study, we have a lot of data on adult survival and fawn survival from 6 years to a year and a half, but we didn't have a whole lot on 0 to 6 months, and that study helped us learn some of the limiting factors there. This is pretty neat. This is a video that we took on the Wasatch unit from the capture company, and I wanted to show it with the rack tonight, or show it to the rack tonight. So this is called a net gun. As you can see, they hang out the helicopter, and when they pursue an animal, they shoot that net, and it just trips them up, tangles them up, and they can bounce around a little bit. And then this person here is called a mugger, and they jump out, and they secure the animal, put a radio collar on it, and get it ready for transport for us. So kind of neat. We talk about the work we do, but we seldom show it, and so I wanted to highlight that. Upland game and waterfowl, we've been really busy. We've translocated 5,300 geese over the last 5 years, a lot of these on golf courses and urban areas and trying to build more tolerance for waterfowl. Translocated close to 5,000 turkeys in the state. The Book Cliffs has been on the receiving end of these translocations. In northern Utah, there's turkeys everywhere, and we still have pockets of southeast Utah and northeast Utah where we're trying to grow them, and so that's been a good program for this region. Quail translocations, we've translocated scaled quail, Gamble's quail, California quail, and then our chucker and pheasant releases. We've released over 10,000 chuckers and 50,000 pheasants over the last 5 years, and that couldn't have been done without the help of our conservation partners and our many volunteers that have helped do that. We appreciate SFW in particular for helping with the pheasant stuff in so many cases. You look at monitoring and research. We've done gobs of sage-grouse research. The last 15 years, it's just been project after project, and learned a lot about these populations, and that's been good for sage-grouse management. Turkey movements. You look at turkey management, like I was saying earlier, some cases they're doing well, some areas they're not, and so we want to learn more about why turkeys thrive in some pockets of the state and why we're struggling to grow them. Ptarmigan research. We got ptarmigan up on the UNs, done some genetics and other research there, and it's just been neat. Mammals, the mammals program. A lot of mountain lion studies in the state. Our most recent one was on the Okra Stansberries with Dustin Mitchell. neat results there. Bear studies, we have bear reproduction monitoring that we do every year, and this helps us identify when we're going to see pulses in bear production. And this helps us when they become yearlings and they start to wander off and they get in trouble. And it's a lot of time and energy and resources to make sure that we're reactive and responsive to bear issues. Switching gears a little bit, I want to introduce the Utah Migration Initiative. Some of you may have heard this. This is pretty neat. The idea here is to identify, preserve, and enhance movement pathways and corridors for species through strong collaborative partnerships, compelling outreach, and the use of advanced tracking and data management technology. Essentially, if you look at Utah, our population is going to grow. It's going to double in the next 30 years. So we're going to grow as a state and as a people. And that's great. That's fine. And as we do so, we want to make sure that we're growing responsibly, that we're not breaking up deer migration routes or you know, pronghorn winter ranges, and these types of things that are really important for wildlife management. Here's a quick video that we put together on the migration initiative. This was down in southern Utah in the Ponsagunt unit, and I'll play it and then speak to it. Pretty neat stuff. Yeah, Clint Sampson and his band. the Untamed Hearts. They put the music together for that, so we're grateful for that. But that's some work we did on the Ponsagunt. It's kind of neat to be able to capture bucks and look at the movements of those animals. I don't know if you noticed or not, one of the bucks still had velvet on their antlers, and I know we brought to this rack before recommendations on cactus bucks, and these are just animals that don't shed their velvet, and so even things, getting radio collars on them and learning about what they do is just really neat. Some of the best data on these species. So anyways, if you haven't been, this is kind of an open invitation to rack members and the public, if you haven't been to one of our wildlife captures, you got to come and spend a day with our biologists. A lot of these occur in the winter months, and very rewarding. So moving on to habitat, this is really fun to present and talk about. With habitat restoration and improvement, we have a watershed restoration program that is second to none. Since 2006, we've had over 100 partners participate in it. And we've done some really neat things through the Watershed Restoration Initiative, or through WRI. The priorities of it are to increase watershed health and biological diversity, improve water quality and yield, and provide opportunities for sustainable uses of natural resources. So this is big picture stuff. We want our landscapes and our ecosystems to be healthier, because when they are, wildlife's going to benefit, livestock's going to benefit. It's just going to be better for the resource. And I know that's a goal that our federal partners have as well. If you look at what WRI's accomplished since 2006, there in the far right, we have our completed projects. We've completed 1,751 projects, treated close to 1.5 million acres, and spent about $186 million in habitat restoration. When you put the $20 million of in-kind or matching funds or volunteer work, that's over $200 million that we've accomplished. We currently have 281 projects in the works. We're treating over 274,000 acres. And again, spending close to $61 million. And then what we have lined up for the very near future is 195 projects, 231,000 acres, and $45 million in funding. So when it's all said and done, when this list gets completed, we'll have treated 2 million acres and spent $300 million. That's a giant investment to put on the landscape. It's more than all the other western states combined during this time period, and it could not be happening without our many great partners that we have. Sportsmen are a big part of that. Federal and state partners are another. So what have we accomplished? There's two types of work that we do. One is proactive restoration, where we see habitat that really isn't that good. Take pinyon juniper, for instance, and we knock it down, and we get an increase in grasses and forbs and shrubs. That's good because it increases forage for deer and elk and cows and different things like that. And then you have fire rehab. You know, we've had the Sealy fire a few years ago. We had Brian Head this year, Milford Flat. Those areas have to be restored. And when they are and it's done well, it saves us a lot of restoration work in the future. And I'll talk about that more in a minute. So where does our funding come from? We talked about a $300 million effort that we're lining up to do. The bulk of that has been federal. The BLM, the Forest Service, those types of partners have really stepped up. And in a lot of ways, it makes sense. A lot of the areas that we treat are public lands, and so it's nice to be able to partner with them and improve those ranges. The second biggest contributor is the state. And oftentimes, we set up programs like Habitat Council, and when you buy a hunting and fishing license, a portion of those dollars goes towards improving the habitat. And then the third biggest contributor is our sportsmen groups. This is where the conservation permit and expo permits funds comes in so heavily. And a lot of times with this state and sportsmen group money, it serves as a match to the federal dollars. And it can be matched several dollars to one in many cases. And that is great, because without that match, you couldn't get as much federal dollars as would be available. And then we have other groups. Our private landowners are big in many areas of the state. Municipalities, counties, volunteers are really appreciative for the work that has been accomplished because people are willing to come together. I want to show some of the restoration priorities that we have. The first thing I want to show is a bull hog. I don't know if anyone's seen this before, but this is one of my favorite machines. You put it on the end of that machine, and it'll just chop through and chip away at these juniper trees. And as it does so, it slashes that wood and spreads it out. And if you look at that landscape, there's not a lot of grass, not a lot of flowers, not a lot of underbrush or anything like that. So it has very limited value for foraging. It's kind of neat to see this thing at work. And then fire restoration. In 2002, we had the Maple Springs fire. We reseeded it with a flame-resistant seed mix. And 11 years later, we had the Black Mountain fire there to the right. And because of the work we did a decade earlier in planting those shrubs and grasses, we were able to make it so that fire didn't spread. And that's a good thing because it gives wildlife a place of refuge, and it preserves forage for livestock on these federal lands, and that's been great. The Tintic fire rehabilitation. This is an interesting place. Historically, we had fire about every 35 to 50 years, and by the 1990s, this was just a tinderbox. It was burning 2 to 3 times a decade. And so we went in and treated it, got some native fire-resistant grasses, and it looks so much better, and that fire interval has been stretched out since. Chaining. This is neat. I'll show a video here. I don't know if anyone's ever witnessed this in person, but it is incredible. You get these two dozers. They pull this giant chain, and it tears up the soil, and it knocks down these trees. And so that way, when we fly on seed, the ground is in a condition to where that restoration work it just has a higher likelihood of taking. And so, you know, right now, when you see a fire go through an area, it can be an eyesore for a couple of years. But if you treat it right, and chaining's been a big part of this, then it can grow back and be more productive. Take Tabby Mountain, for instance. This is an area that we chained. It didn't burn. But on the left, you can kind of see in 2007, before we did the two-way chaining, what that looks like. And again, just very limited value for wildlife and livestock. And 4 years later, you look at the right, the picture on the right, you have more grasses, more forbs and flowers and sagebrush benefit livestock and wildlife. I'll end with this, with Kingston Canyon WMA. We do a lot of stream restoration work. This is an area in southern Utah that if you're a deer, you can't even get a drink of water from that right side. And there's so much silt and sediment coming into that fisheries. It's just it's not good for water users downstream or for the conditions there. So we firmed up the banks, and the willows came back, and which is really good for songbirds and other things. A lot of species benefits, not just deer and elk. It's a lot of these species benefit, and that fisheries is much better. So in summary, I just want to say the division and our partners, and I'm really grateful for our partners, they're trying to improve wildlife management. We are, through monitoring and research. The Watershed Restoration Initiative is restoring habitat at an extremely aggressive rate, and that has a lot of benefits to wildlife, livestock, and the ecosystem as a whole. And then finally, funding for these projects comes from a variety of sources, and a large portion of that comes from our hunters, the conservation permits and the expo permits, and then the general license sales as well. So that's kind of the 30,000 foot view. What I've done is asked Dax, and Miles, are you going to go as well? Give kind of an update more on site specific local Northeast region projects. I thought that might be beneficial. So who wants to go first?
All right, now I'm Dax Mangus. I'm the Regional Wildlife Program Manager. I'm glad to have an opportunity to talk about this. I'm actually really really thankful that Justin's given this presentation. We met with a group of sportsmen a while back and went through some of this stuff that we're doing specific to this northeastern region. And we met with a lot of sportsmen and groups that were leaders in sportsmen's organizations. After the meeting, I had several of them come up to me and say, "Oh wow, I had no idea you were doing any of these things." And I thought, "Man, we're not doing a good job spreading the word about the things that we have going on." So this is a great opportunity to share some of these exciting things we have happening right here in this region. I have on there NER, Northeastern Region abbreviation, but just in the last 3 years, 9,450 pheasants released in this region. Some of those have come from the Division of Wildlife, and a large portion of those were purchased by Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife that contribute a lot, and that's something that's been really popular and really well received here in the Uinta Basin. 592 chuckers. This is a fun one. We've really been on the receiving end, been really lucky to get a lot of turkeys from the other regions that have had trouble with turkeys, and here I am releasing some out in the Book Cliffs. This was last January. So, but we're excited about turkeys in the northeastern region. Our public likes them, and we have a lot of great turkey habitat that's not yet occupied or doesn't have as many birds as it could have. And we have a lot of places where they're far away from golf courses and people's porches. So we've got a lot of room for turkeys in this region. This year, because of the lower snow depths, we were able to access a lot of country across the South Slope, where normally we can't get in when we are receiving those turkeys from the Central Region, Northern Region. So, Book Cliffs has been a great place, but this year we hit a lot more spots on the South Slope as well for turkey releases, and Daggett County too. This year, 2018, we released 711 turkeys on public lands. In the last 4 years, over 1,600 birds released on public lands in the region. You can see that young fellow there on the right with the turkey. That was one that had a band on its leg and had come from, I think it was Cache Valley, where that turkey came from. So we've had, we put bands on the toms. The folks captured and put bands on some of the toms, and we've had quite a few band returns from folks that have harvested some of those toms. And then, of course, all the hens and jennies, they're out there, they're reproducing, and I'm optimistic about the future of turkeys in our region. They're not a problem yet, but maybe someday they will be. But for now, we're loving the turkeys. We keep a sample of collars out on bears, and there's Derek and Randall running away from one that wasn't quite fully tranquilized. they got up and started handling her to put the collar on or check the collar, and she started waking up. So, we keep a subset, a sample out on bears throughout the region, and we check those annually, looking at survival and production. We do big game survey work. Our guys just finished up our pronghorn flights. We do elk and moose flights, bison flights, mountain goat flights. And, you know, it sounds really fun to be there in the helicopter or the fixed wing. And it is for a while, but, you know, those pronghorn flights on a really warm day, it starts getting warm and the plane starts bouncing around a little bit. And a little button on the top of your hat, I've had that little button hit under the roof of the airplane so hard I thought it punctured my skull. So, and I've puked more than once, too. And I'm not the only one, so... it is a neat experience. It's maybe not quite as fun as it sounds, but it's a neat experience, and it really helps us get an idea of what we've got out there, and helps us understand, you know, where these animals are, how many we have. You know, we're classifying animals, looking at you know, adult to young ratios, female to young ratios, and this helps us in managing the resource. We've got a lot of GPS collars out. This is amazing. We are really living in an awesome time where we're transitioning from this old technology, these VHF collars, to GPS collars. It's almost overwhelming, the quantity and quality of data that we're getting from these GPS collars. But it's such a neat time to be right in the thick of things as we really transition to a new generation of understanding wildlife habitat utilization and movement. We've got over 100 collars out. We keep on a South Slope deer survival study looking at adult does and fawns. We had 300 collars out on the Wasatch Unit, one of the largest GPS elk collar studies ever. Justin referred to that one a little bit, and a lot of that was our region. We've got bighorn sheep collars on the Aviniquin Unit, also up on the North Slope on our bighorn, and more. There's a picture of Brian Maxfield with the sage grouse that he affixed a GPS transmitter kind of backpack unit on. They don't do a collar, it's kind of a little backpack. And Brian is nocturnal, he just works at night. And poor guy, never sleeps. And but we have 43 active GPS transmitters out on grouse right now. There on the right, that's a map of all those points, our individual points. Each color is a different grouse, that's in the Blue Mountain area. So as I mentioned, just the quantity and quality of data we're getting on wildlife movement is just amazing, as well as, you know, the let counts and the other things we do for sage grouse as well. We are really lucky in this region. We have Amy Vandevoort, who is a fantastic district biologist, but also manages the Browns Park Waterfowl Management Area. And Amy really has two jobs, and she does them both really well, which is twice as good as I do. I have one job and I do it kind of mediocre. But you know, Amy's doing weed control. You can see there on the bottom left picture, that's some thistle. And they've got some biocontrol agents, some little bugs that target the thistle. And Amy's been using biocontrols as well as spraying and traditional weed suppression methods as well. Urban goose relocation. We've taken some of those pesky golf course geese and urban area geese and released some in Browns Park, and it's been really a great success. Amy does a lot of dove banding, goose banding, waterfowl surveys. We actually have a really active waterfowl management program in that Browns Park area. There's a lot of neat things going on up there. And sometimes Amy's kind of under the radar. We forget that over the mountain it's still our region. It feels like Wyoming up there almost, but there's a lot of great stuff going on up there, and Amy works really hard. The Book Cliffs Migration Initiative study, this is a really exciting project, and it's really kind of groundbreaking when you look at the diversity of species that we're going to have GPS transmitter collars on. This last year we put out 21 collars on bison, GPS transmitter collars on bison, 100 deer collars. This next spring, next March, we're looking at putting the VITs, the vaginal implant transmitters, on deer and on elk both. And those activate when they give birth, and then we're able to go catch the deer fawn or the elk calf and put a collar on that deer fawn and that elk calf. And we have some questions we've really wondered about for a long time out there about survival, neonate survival. Why aren't we recruiting as many of these calves and fawns into the population? And I think this is really going to help us get some answers to those questions. We're also working on a predator component. I think this next year, we're really close to finalizing funding for a cougar study where we put some GPS collars on cougars, and we're looking at bears into the future as well. So really exciting stuff. And that's it. Just, it's not necessarily a comprehensive list, but just some highlights of some of the some of the neat on-the-ground, hands-on wildlife projects that we have going on just right here in this region.
Thanks, Dex. Miles?
I'm Miles Hanberg. I'm the habitat manager here in the Northeast region. So it's exciting to be able to talk to you guys a little bit tonight about habitat work specific to this region. I can talk for hours on this stuff. So if you ever have any other questions, feel free to contact me. I mean, there's really a lot to think about and consider. But any questions that come tonight, you know, feel free to contact me anytime. So I'll start off. Justin, you know, previously showed a map across the state of all the habitat projects. This is just zoomed in on the region. So this has been since that 2005 time period. It shows the habitat work's been completed in this region. You know, a lot of these areas overlap where we have bulk of our deer and elk populations, especially winter habitat, but also focuses on a lot of our sage grouse habitat. It's been a big focus over the years to improve in sage grouse numbers and habitat across the state. So right now, this is the list of projects we're working on right now. It's our fiscal year 18 projects that we're trying to get done by the end of June. So there's quite a few projects. We're being pretty successful in getting those done this year. There's a couple projects ongoing right now. We have some lop and scatter work out in the book list on the divide that's going on. That's where crews come in and cut trees out of our mountain browse and sagebrush communities with chainsaws. There's also a big mastication project going up in the Little Hole area on the Diamond side. It's got 5 trackos up there with the mastication heads. So that's a couple of projects that are actually going on right now as we speak. This is just a quick map that shows what's proposed. Funding decisions haven't been completely shorn up, but they will in the next week or two. But this is the amount of projects. And you look at the map and think, well, I don't know, those squares aren't that big, but it's a pretty big area. It's a lot of acreage. So pretty aggressive program still continues on out here. And it's really due to the large partnership involving a lot of our partners with different land management agencies as well as private landowners and others. So this kind of gives an idea. Since 2005, just in this region, there's been almost $25 billion spent. That's about 155,000 acres treated. Right now, we're working on almost a $5 million budget this year. The target was almost 30,000 acres. And for what's being developed, starting hopefully this fall, that's over $5 million and almost 40,000 acres. So it's a pretty aggressive program. This is kind of a small region of the state, but we still get a lot of acres done out here, so it's exciting work. Justin already showed you some other pictures. This is one of the bigger bull hog machines, one of the tiger cat machines, wheeled version, but they can explode one of those trees like it's behind in just not even a minute, it's gone. So it's pretty neat. It shreds up all the material. It's really quick and dirty way to get rid of a tree, but treating larger acres, it's a little bit slower compared to chaining method. This is a chaining we did over by Tabby Mountain, I think back in about 2007 or 8 when this project happened. So that's a couple of the main methods we're doing, that and as well as the lop and scatter method. There's also a lot of stream restoration work going on here, fire rehab, lots of different things. So like I say, in the interest of time, I won't go into everything, but kind of just more highlights. Just a quick example, this is up Goslin Mountain, north side of Goslin Mountain in 2008. See, those pinyon trees, or those juniper trees, are really starting to take over that site. So this treatment involved a bull hog. You see in 2010, trees are gone, a lot of grass came back. And then 2013, you see like the bitterbrush shrubs, some of those are all increasing in size and stature. So starting to create a lot more forage for big game species out there. Just quick numbers, you see, you know, grass has really increased since the beginning. Sagebrush for wintering big game has increased and bitter brush since the beginning of the treatment as well. So pretty dramatic differences. I'll kind of speed through these. This was up on the face of Diamond Mountain. It's one you drive past all the time. There was really no understory left in this site for treatment. This was treated in 2004. 2010, you can see we had a great response on grasses, but there are shrubs present. They're just a little bit smaller. But in 2012, you can really see our shrubs becoming more apparent. Quickly, I'll talk about sagebrush. A lot of people don't like sagebrush. Some people do. There's different kinds of sagebrush out on the landscape. We really like these Wyoming sagebrush communities in our lower elevation areas. That's the stuff that winter our big game species, especially mule deer. As you get higher up on the mountain, you get into the mountain sagebrush community, that's not so important. So these lower elevation areas, that's why we're really trying to strive to increase sagebrush habitat for these wintering big game species.
Are you okay?
Yeah.
I just saw you clutching your
shoulder.
That shows more of the numbers. Again, across the board, we have increases in basically everything except for Utah juniper, which is good. This is Tabby Mountain area. Same story, just a tremendous amount of forage created from these projects. And another one, this is south of Duchesne on Skaitze Ridge. This one we've had a little less response on brush. It's taken a little more time. But it's important to note all these sites are ones that were getting advanced in the pinyon juniper level, so it's taking more time to get some of those shrubs back on the landscape. So one of the questions you have to ask is, or has been asked, is are we doing any good with these treatments? And I think it's all kind of obvious that we are. We recently had collared a bunch of deer in the book cliffs. I just browsed on a few of these animals, but this is one doe deer from this winter. And you can see she spent all winter basically on this one treated point in the book cliffs. So what's really kind of interesting is, yeah, we can see that the docs are using it now, but through migration initiative and work that Clint and Dax will be doing, they can go back and actually capture this doe now and see if she has better body condition scores, if her fawns have survived better. And you compare that across the state and start to actually document scientifically the benefit that some of these treatments have for big game species. So this next slide shows bison in the book cliffs on the Steep Ridge area. Of course, they don't stay just in the treatment all the time, but this is pretty compelling that all those light areas having been treated, bison are really utilizing those in the Steep Ridge area, and they're spending a lot of time. Of course, there's lots of good grass in there for them to eat after it's been treated, so it's really pretty neat to see the response just with the short time period that we've had this data available. It's really neat. The other thing we've been doing a lot of things here in the region is working on our guzzlers, our guzzler program. We've opened up some really great habitats out there through some of our watershed projects. Not always have we had the best water resources available. So one of the ways we're attempting to do that is through guzzler development. This shows a map of what we currently have in the region. Each one of the guzzlers we install holds 1,800 gallons of water. But, you know, it rains all year, hopefully, and so we may be actually capturing more than 1,800 gallons. But right now we have about 215 gallons. That means we can store, you know, 387,000 gallons of water. So each year, last five or so years, we've been targeting about 25 to 30 new guzzler constructions. So it's a pretty aggressive program. But the wildlife love them, and we have a great response by all types of wildlife. Basically, you name them wildlife species, and we've got a picture of it using a guzzler, but bears really like to bath in them. So, anyhow, there's always a bear taking a dip. So, anyhow, some other images, bison, deer, everything are using these guzzlers out on the landscape. So, it's been pretty exciting to see some of this work being done. Fox, you see a lot of fox on guzzlers. It's really cool to see the diversity that comes to use these water sources. So just a quick recap. As far as funding, projects are funded largely through the Watershed Initiative, Habitat Council. But the conservation permit funding, and that's, they're some of our main funders of a lot of our water projects. They've really stepped up to fund some of those other projects, and it's been exciting. So there's a whole list of funding sources out there, but it's Justin covered that pretty well previously. So the other thing we're still looking at is the Sea Bridge Road and the potential impacts to mule deer from that road being improved and paved. There's six crossing structures that were installed in the construction. However, there was no fencing associated with those. This is a picture of one of those crossing structures that was installed out in the book list. This is a map of the six of them. They were focused on crucial deer winter ranges. Those deer come down every year, spend their time right along this road. We wanted to make sure that we'd have that ability to cross those deer of traffic volumes and road kills became overly problematic for that population. So just quick some numbers. Basically, we had zero road kills before the road was paved. And the numbers have increased quite significantly compared to zero. But one of the things that's really interesting is even though it's a big road out there, for the most part, traffic volumes haven't really increased. There's been some traffic associated with a few of the tar sand and oil shale developments, but road terminates at the county line. So as there are proposals to continue that road I-70, once the traffic volume increases, with these increased speeds we currently have, we look for that mortality rate to increase significantly at this point. So this is a stagnant population, as Dax may have alluded to before, trying to figure out why we don't have the recruitment levels. Population is below objective, so we feel like any reduction in our survival is a problem for this population. So something we're watching pretty closely. Other things, this is the first documented case in North America of bison using wildlife crossing structures. So I've been working with Dr. Patty Kramer. She's really excited about that. She's kind of one of the leading experts on wildlife crossings in the United States. So she's working on summarizing some of our images. We've got about 600,000 of those to go through. And so essentially there's two cameras on each crossing to document success and failure of each group of animals that may approach that. As fencing is installed, of course, we would expect to see those numbers increase dramatically. What's really exciting is these structures are adequate, that it's crossing animals now when they don't really have to use them. So that means they're going to be good structures in the case of later down the road if we end up having to fence this stretch of road. Anyhow, have a quick version, maybe not quick, but like I say, I could talk for hours, so feel free to contact me anytime anybody from the RAP or the public has any other questions. So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Miles. Up next, Marty Bushman. He's our Assistant Attorney General.
Again, my name is Marty Bushman. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. It works with the Division of Wildlife Resources, and here tonight to present an informational item on some county resource management plans which have been coming out over the last couple of years, and there's questions that have arisen of how do these plans interplay with the Division of Wildlife Resources' role as a wildlife manager when these plans also cover issues of wildlife and wildlife management. So to begin with, in 2016, the Utah legislature enacted a statute that directed counties to prepare comprehensive management plans. These plans were designed to address a wide variety of resource issues within them, including predator control, wildlife, fisheries, and threatened endangered species. The plans, you know, although many of them address predator control, wildlife, fisheries, and T&E species, the legislature was clear that it did not intend that these plans would supersede or override the authority of the Division of Wildlife Resources as set out in the Wildlife Resources Code. The statute itself had a clause that, quote, said nothing in this part may be construed to limit the authority of the state to manage and protect wildlife under Title 23 Wildlife Resources Code. So with that being the standard, is that the county resource management plans are not designed to override the statutory authority of the division. Thought it'd be kind of helpful to go through some of those authorities real quick as they relate to wildlife, to the RACs, and to the wildlife board. So first, division and code is designated as trustee and custodian of protected wildlife. It is also made clear there that wildlife within the state, whether on private or public land, is within the jurisdiction of the division. And then finally, subject to the policy making authority of the Wildlife Board, the division is charged to protect, propagate, manage, conserve, and distribute protected wildlife throughout the state. Regional advisory councils have statutory responsibilities as well, and there they are directed to hear broad input, recommendations, biological data, and information regarding the effects of wildlife. Also to gather information from staff, the public, and government agencies, and finally to make recommendations to the Wildlife Board. The board's authorities in turn are to establish the policies that are best designed to accomplish and fulfill the intent of all laws pertaining to wildlife, including the preservation, protection, conservation, perpetuation, introduction, and management of wildlife. As the board goes through its policy-making responsibilities, it's also asked or charged to weigh a variety of different factors. One is to recognize that wildlife is an essential and healthy part of a healthy environment. To also recognize the economic impacts of wildlife on private property and local communities. To seek to balance the habitat requirements of wildlife with the social and economic activities of man. To recognize the social and economic values of wildlife. Seek to maintain wildlife on a sustainable basis, and lastly, to consider the recommendations of the regional advisory councils. In the Wildlife Code, it also addresses a couple specific topics in terms of translocations as one of them, that we get some very specific direction from the legislature when we're transplanting big game, wolves, turkeys, or sensitive species. In those plans, we have to identify proposed transplant sites. You have to vet these plans with potentially affected landowners, local government officials, and the Resource Development Coordinating Committee. Plans are then submitted to the regional advisory councils, particularly the regions that are affected by these translocation plans, for their recommendation to the Wildlife Board. And finally, the plans have to be approved by the Wildlife Board. Also, when the division develops wildlife management plans, the legislature has given some direction there as well. So when these management plans are made for deer and elk, and the statute only addresses deer and elk, but the division follows this process with virtually all of its management plans that are all overall species. One is to establish target herd size objectives, to consider the range carrying capacity of the unit, to seek to balance relevant multiple uses on the range, and to seek and consider input from federal and state land managers, private landowners, sportsmen, and ranchers. The plan is then presented to the regional advisory councils for consideration and recommendation to the board. And again, finally, plans must be approved by the Wildlife Board. So these are the statutory processes the legislature has created for the Division of Wildlife Resources in the management of wildlife in the state. Back to the county resource management plans. Some of these plans express positions on wildlife management matters, including population objectives, management plans, and translocations. And what the division, the regional advisory councils, and Wildlife Board should do when they get these plans is to carefully consider and weigh the positions in those plans when making recommendations and decisions that implicate them. But we do need to keep in mind that the plans do not control or bind the state when exercising its wildlife management authority under Title 23. The legislature was clear that it did not intend for these plans, these resource management plans, to supersede the state's authority to manage wildlife. The state also completed its resource management plan this past year. It was approved and adopted by the legislature this past session. The plan covers many of the same topics as do the county plans, things including wildlife and fisheries and threatened and endangered species. In that process, they also reaffirm and recognize the division's authority to manage wildlife. In the plan that was adopted by the legislature, it states that the process for determining the balance among competing uses and establishing the best fishery and wildlife management policies is declared in state law through the RAC and Wildlife Board process. So just to wrap this up, is in conclusion, what are the takeaways from this? That the division, the RAC, Wildlife Board should evaluate and seriously consider the positions that are being taken concerning wildlife objectives and goals in county RMPs when they're making their decisions. But in the end, the final decision does rest with the state and according to the processes that have been outlined in the Wildlife Code. That concludes my little informational presentation. If anybody has questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Anybody have any questions for Marty? Yep.
Yeah, I've got a question, Marty, for you. So how is it different? How is that statewide resource management plan different than the counties?
They cover many of the same topics, and as I understand it, the state plan is essentially looking at all the county plans and synthesizing it down to what it, you know, considers from a state perspective would be all of the important objectives and, you know, policies that they want to pursue given the variety of various resource management issues. So. Anybody else? All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Marty. Next on the agenda, we've got the wild turkey recommendations and rule amendments. Turn the time over to Jason Robinson, our upland game coordinator. Action item.
I'm Avery Cook. I'm the Upland Game Project Leader for the Utah Division of Wildlife. I'm filling in for Jason Robinson today. And I'll be presenting the Upland Game and Wild Turkey Guidebook Rules and Recommendations for the 2018-19 Guidebook. So just a little background on the Upland Game Guidebook process. So we just finished 1 year of the three-year guidebook approval, so most of the Upland Game Guidebook regulations were approved last year. So this proposal today is just adjusting rules primarily focused on the fall hunt. So the turkey populations are doing quite well in Utah. They've been on a general upward trend the last couple decades with a few dips from some harsh winters. But as you saw earlier in some of the wildlife presentations with the transplants we're doing. They're doing very well in some parts of the states to the point where they're causing some nuisance and depredation concerns. And we would like to have some additional options for management actions to address some of these turkey issues. So in our general fall hunt and spring hunts, we evaluate the hunts based on three criteria when we're looking at permit numbers primarily. So we do look at a three-year average hunter success and try and keep that hunt success over 20%. Also look at a three-year average hunter crowding and try and keep that below 4 on a 1-5 scale. And also look at a three-year average hunter satisfaction and try and keep that above a 2 on a 1-5 scale. So if we get outside of those parameters, that is a flag to us to either adjust permit numbers or season dates. Looking at kind of the history of the spring hunt, the total permits have been on a general upward trend. That 2010 peak year was the first year of the general over-the-counter unlimited permit. A limited permit numbers within the state. After that year, we had a little bit of a dip in permit numbers, and that's pretty typical after introducing over-the-counter hunt. as people, a lot of people try it the first year, you don't get everybody coming back that second year, but as the populations have continued to grow in the state, we've seen hunter permit numbers continue up. And the harvest has been fluctuating, but also is on an upward trend. Spring hunter success has also been generally trending upward and is well above our target of 20%. We average 32% for the over-the-counter and limited entry spring hunts combined. Hunter crowding has remained very stable over the last few years, especially since we started the over-the-counter hunt. So we've had quite an increase in over-the-counter and limited entry hunters, but the perceived crowding has remained basically the same, and that's, I think, a lot of effect of that is the increased area and increased amount of occupied habitat throughout the state, so hunters are dispersing themselves, and there's not really been an increase in perceived crowding despite an increase in hunter numbers. Hunt satisfaction is much of the same story. It's kind of trending up, but pretty stable for both the limited entry and over-the-counter, and again, it's 3.9 on our hunter survey, which well exceeds our target of 2. Looking at the fall wild turkey, so we had the first fall hunt in recent history, 2014 and 15. Each year for the fall hunt, we adjust boundaries and permit numbers based on areas of overabundance. So the fall hunt's a either sex hunt, so it does have more of an effect on a population than the spring hunts, which are male turkeys only. And the total harvest has been going up the last few years since we've implemented the spring hunt, but the permit numbers have fluctuated as we've adjusted for different areas in the state. All wild turkey hunt success is very high, so it's hunt success has ranged from almost 80% down to about 50%, so quite a bit higher than the spring hunts. And the hunters of field has fluctuated kind of along with the permit numbers, and some fluctuations also due to weather. Crowding, perceived crowding on the fall hunt is very low. Not a lot of permits out there, not a ton of hunters, and pretty well distributed. Also, the hunter satisfaction is very high. With that background, I'll kind of talk about the recommendations we're bringing to the board. So these rules are primarily addressing the fall hunt. The general structure of the hunt is going to remain the same. So with the fall hunt, the main objective is primarily as a management hunt, where we've got very specific small hunt boundaries within each region, and those are primarily put in areas where we've had depredation and nuisance problems. We've done previous efforts with transplants and hazing and other methods to try and reduce those complaints and problems, but we haven't been able to get the complaints down to tolerable levels, or get the populations down to tolerable levels. So these permits are still going to be sold over the counter, first come, first serve, but there is a cap on permits set by each region. So each region draws, if they've got depredation or nuisance problems, they draw the hunt boundary specific to where they're having depredation or nuisance problems. And then within the region, there's a cap set for how many permits should be sold. We are proposing to move the opening date back 1 month to October 1st. So that's just a maximum range that could be October 1st to February 28th. Again, within a region, the region could set the hunt dates from whatever period they'd like within that maximum boundary of October 1st to February 28th. Currently, the Northeast region does not have any fall hunts as we're trying to build the population here. There's no point system, so no bonus or preference points for people who are not able to obtain a tag. There's a 15% allocation for youth. And the other change we're proposing is to change the number of permits available per hunter from 1 to 3 for those either sex permits for the fall. That change the overall cap, so the overall number of permits available per region would still be set per region, but an individual hunter could obtain 3. So those recommendations fall into 2 rules. The first one is taking wild turkeys, R657-54. Another change we're proposing is to the weapon requirements. So currently we've got shot size restrictions and gauge restrictions. We're proposing to change that to any shotgun firing shot size BB and smaller. That primarily is to accommodate changes in weapons technology. So tungsten super shot has been coming on the market, and it's a ultra dense material to use for shotgun pellets, and you can basically get the same sectional density and effectiveness of a much larger diameter pellet in a small pellet size, so people are able to use number 9 shot on turkeys effectively. So that regulation is just to allow that newer ammunition type to be used with appropriate firearms for that ammunition type. We're also proposing to allow rimfire weapons for the fall hunt. And that's the fall hunt only. Spring hunt would remain shotgun only hunt, or shotgun or archery. Looking at using rim fires for the fall hunt, again, it's mostly a management hunt aimed at reducing populations in very specific areas. And we feel that allowing rim fire would allow some people that don't traditionally turkey hunt to start turkey hunting. Some opportunity for youth there, where younger youth hunters who would not be able to handle a traditional 12 turkey load would be able to get out hunting turkeys, also be able to take some birds at longer distances for the spring hunt where they are not responding to calls like they do in the fall hunt where they aren't responding to calls like they do in the spring. Also looking at going back to the permits again, simplifying permits. 1 spring and 3 fall versus the current system where we've got a number of different categories of permits, each with their own quota. So basically just putting them into calendar period categories. And then conservation permits would be in addition to the 1 spring and 3 fall permits. Corresponding changes to the turkey depredation rule, so R657-69. Again, that same change, simplifying permits to 3 fall per hunter, which would be up to 3 fall permits in combination, including that fall general season, but also that would include depredation hunts if a hunter was called up out of a depredation hunter pool, or control permit vouchers, which are awarded to landowners or lessees who are having depredation or nuisance problems on their property. A landowner control permits, which can be awarded to landowners on those nuisance and depredation plans, would also be in addition to the 3 fall. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions by the rack?
I have one. What's the driving force of the rim fire if you're at 80% success already without the rim fire?
It's basically an internal recommendation where we're looking at ways to increase success in specific areas where we weren't having as high success. Some of the open agricultural fields where we were getting depredation complaints.
So the average success you showed up there, there were certain areas where you have issues of not getting adequate success.
So that's just the average. So it's somewhat variable between units.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question. Has there been any consideration to allow the limited entry permit holders in the spring to extend their season over to the general season portion if they're unsuccessful?
There has been some discussion of that, but that's unrelated to the fall hunt. I don't believe that we are going to recommend that change.
Mr. Chair, I've got a question.
Dan?
Yeah. So another question. The up to three fall permits, turkey permits, that has to be in combination then?
No. You could get just three fall general permits.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Other questions, by the way?
I wanted to Dan's question. So it's over the counter, first come, first serve.
Correct.
So they could, the first person, they could buy three tags.
Correct.
On the spot.
Okay, we'll come back to the rack. Questions by the public? Any questions? I'm not seeing any. I did receive one email on this one that of a concern. But I guess I got a question. How's the other racks? Have they received much input on this topic? Was there a lot of discussion at the other racks?
I did not attend the Northern or Central rack. Maybe Justin or somebody. Yeah, the Northern Central. There was very little at the Southern and some discussion at the Southeast.
Yeah, so some of the discussions at the Central and Northern rack centered around safety and the use of a rimfire. Good discussions that ended up passing both racks.
Thank you. All right. Well, we'll come back to the rack for discussion. Any comments, concerns? Yeah, Daniel?
One more question. Sorry. Has there been any issues with them fall permits not selling out completely, or is everything sold to limit?
I believe they have sold out.
Can I ask a question real quick on the rimfire? I'm assuming other states allow rimfire.
Yeah, there are other states that allow rimfire and other states that allow center fire for turkey.
Okay, no higher incidence of accidents or damage?
No, it seems to be no higher than other small game hunting.
Any comments? Discussion?
I think as a sportsman want an opportunity, you know, three permits per individual with a cap kind of sets a tendency for some greediness, whether they harvest all three or not. I kind of like the idea of, say, a two-bag limit so it can disperse that opportunity amongst the rest of the sportsmen.
How does others feel?
I would agree with either two or one because it's over the counter, so you're going to have some. If they're already selling out, I don't follow the rationale for multiple tags if they're over the counter.
I also agree.
Okay.
And my concern, a lot of feedback I've got too, has been the rimfire instance. The depredation issues where your hunters are in the depredation pool, I can see a necessity with that because it'll more than likely target those open areas that are hard to hunt, so the birds tend to hang out there because they can see their avenues of ambush and be able to escape a little bit easier. But, you know, the perception and feedback I've got has not been well received with the rimfire amendment or proposal, sorry.
I've got a question.
Yeah, Tim?
Well, what do you got left to eat?
Depends on how good a shot you are. Other discussion? Anybody want to entertain a motion? Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Thank you. Straighten me out here. We've got one comment. We're going, now it's time for comments. Get your cards up here. We've got Kevin Norman's going to have a comment. We're going to put him on it up first, and then Troy Justison.
Kevin Norman. Representing SFW, we support the division's recommendations on this. The only thing we ask we keep in mind is the option we have to translocate turkeys. There's a lot of areas that are overpopulated. We understand that and the depredation process, but there's also options to translocate turkeys into areas that need them. So we just ask we don't lose sight of that option. Also, speaking as a father of a 9-year-old little girl, I believe this rimfire option opens up a lot of options for our youth. There's no way I would take her out and put her behind a shotgun, let her get knocked on her can. She'd probably never want to go hunting again, but I believe she could have a very positive experience here in a short time with the rimfire option and get her started off on the right foot with hunting. And so I support the rimfire option that the division's proposed. Thanks.
Thank you, Kevin. Troy?
Troy Justinson, representing myself, having traveled all the racks and hearing the discussion, the main discussion's really been on the safety issue of the rimfire. And, you know, quite honestly, they talked about other states where it is legal. It's legal here in Colorado, and they've actually stated that they've had more incidents with that of a shotgun than they have rimfire. Now, keep in mind, it is legal to smoke pot there, and so that may be the reason why. But as a whole, no. Kevin hit a very important part, and I think the thing we need to realize is that this is a great opportunity. We don't want to lose sight of the ability to move these birds. And the division did a great job last year. They moved over, I think, 200 birds last year. That's amazing, 2,200 birds. And so I would use that as a first option, being able to take the birds, transplant them into areas that we have some open areas for them. But the other areas, we have no problem with utilizing this opportunity with the rimfire and the fall hunts. Thank you.
You're talking mainly depredation areas, right?
Correct. And that's, I think, another important thing to realize is this is in specific areas dealing with depredation, like in Mendon and northern Utah.
Okay. Thank you, Troy. Okay, that's the only two comments, cards I had on this. Going once, twice. Okay, back to discussion. Any other discussion before I call for a vote? Or call for an amendment, or call for a motion. It's my first night.
So, again, just for clarification, the rimfire is open for anybody, or is it youth specified?
Anybody.
Yeah, it's specifically for the fall hunt. So any fall,
right.
Anybody hunting the fall hunt would be eligible for rimfire. Both the fall general and some of the depredation hunts.
You bet. Cool. Thank you.
Is there any way to find out, I guess, the time period of when the tags sell out? Does it take 3 days? Does it take 3 months to sell tags out?
That's true.
Right now.
It's generally in the days to weeks time period.
Okay, so it's pretty quick time period. You got to get off the couch pretty quick to get these.
Yes.
Any other questions or comments? it sounds to me like what Daniel was talking about is actually, and Brett, is actually a pretty good idea, because if these sell out so quickly, having 200 guys get tagged instead of 2,000 guys get tagged.
And if we've not had issues with not selling them out, I mean, that here we are creating opportunity, encouraging recruitment, applaud the idea. I mean, of course, I'd like to be greedy and be able to hunt the entire season and kill multiple birds, but, you know, if we're selling tags and our success rate's that high, then...
And the overcrowding isn't an issue. I mean, we just showed us overcrowding isn't an issue, so...
So no need to limit the number in the field.
Well, anybody want... I'll entertain a motion. Anybody want to make a motion?
I'll make a motion. Make a motion that we maintain the permits to one permit per hunter in the fall. That we accept the any gauge proposal for the... BB shot recommendation, and that we limit the rimfire use to depredation and youth only.
Okay, did we get that?
Yeah.
Tell us what you got.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I just tried to do everything at once.
No, you did. You did well.
Correct.
Okay, we have a motion. Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
Tim Ignacio made the second.
Can we amend the motion?
Is there any further discussion? If you don't like the motion, now's the time to amend it.
Well, I guess I like Daniel's proposal, other than maybe if we because it's three turkeys per hunter right now, right?
No.
Currently it's one.
Our motion is one.
We're recommending up to three.
Up to three. Okay. And you don't have an overcrowding issue. You don't feel like you have an overcrowding issue.
Not according to
that. No, we don't feel like we have an overcrowding issue. Part of the motivation behind that three was to allow, especially for certain landowners trying to limit the number of people on their properties and making the logistics easier for them, awarding the permits that are awarded as part of a depredation plan. Okay. So the control permit vouchers too, in addition to the depredation permits. And then I guess another thing that I kind of neglected to mention earlier is the general season permits have been trending up, and we, rather than awarding more and more of those depredation permits, we'd like to shift people over to just getting general season permits. It would be cheaper for them and less paperwork for everybody, so that was part of the motivation behind that three permits per individual, is to make it easier for landowners to get their permit vouchers out and get people on their property.
Okay.
To remove turkeys when needed.
Well, I like both arguments. I would maybe like to see the difference split and go to two, see what it does for a year, and we could change it next year.
So you want to amend the motion, is that what I'm hearing, to instead of just one permit, to two permits per hunter, but leave the other two items the same?
Correct. Do you want me to make that motion?
Mr. Chair.
It's up to you if you want to make that motion.
Not more discussion. Mr. Chair, we've had a motion by Daniel, a second by Tim.
Yep. Shouldn't we need a vote?
Vote before we...
No, if we want to amend it, now's the time to amend it.
We amend it
before a vote. Yep.
Amend it, or if it fails, then you make a new motion.
So, in the motion, is the rimfire just for depredation and not for youth? What about including youth on the...
I think it was for depredation and youth.
Both.
Only.
Everybody.
Both.
Both?
Yeah.
The only thing that he was recommending changing in the original motion was to for two permits, not one.
And limiting the rimfire to youth and...
Yeah, the same thing as what was originally presented by Daniel Davis.
Oh, I'm sorry, the new motion. Okay. Yeah.
So did you want to make that amendment, Richie?
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay, so what I think he's amending is Daniel's motion is exactly the same with exception of two tags instead of one. And I need a second on that or it fails.
Do we want to do one of each sex? Okay. All right. Yes, yeah, I think the way you stated it's correct.
Okay, so do I have a second on that amendment? I'm not hearing a second, so that failed. We go back to the original motion that Daniel made, which we have a second on. We'll call for a vote on that. All in favor? One, raise your hand high if you want a favor of. One, two, three, four, five. Do I have opposed? One, two, three, opposed. Motion passes. Okay, thank you. Next on our next action item we have is the Coyote Bounty Program Amendments. And is it, I'm going to butcher your name, so Miss Walden. Tell me what your first, how you say that? Zava? Jayla. Oh, thank you.
Nobody seconded the amendment that stated the one permit in the fall.
Mr. Secretary,
you did write
that.
Yeah, I've got to write that too. I'm sure it's.
I'm sure she's got it, but it wasn't. I didn't write it down, so that is a pretty long one to remember.
Yeah. So I'm Jayla Walden. I am a predator management specialist for the division, and I will be presenting on Rule 657-64, which pertains to the predator control program. So a little bit of background on the program. It was initiated back in 2012 under the Mule Deer Protection Act, and the purpose of the program is to protect non-predatory wildlife, specifically geared towards protecting mule deer. The way the program works is legislation allocates funding every year to the program, and then the division administers the program by paying out participants $50 per coyote that they submit that's properly documented. And the way participants submit coyotes is they turn in the scalp and the lower jaw to designated check-in stations along with a compensation form, which they record the date, the location, the sex, and the method of take of each coyote. For members of the public to become a participant, they must go online and take an education course, which then qualifies them to participate. So a quick overview of our proposed changes. The first, we are recommending that we require a COR to participate in the program. Second, we recommend standardizing the conditions that we accept samples in. Third, we are recommending having the ability to alter payments based on where we are in relation to the budget of the previous fiscal year. And fourth, we are recommending the requirement of using an electronic application to submit coyotes. So our first recommendation is requiring the use of a certificate of registration. Participants aren't going to see a huge difference with this. What's going to happen is this page that's shown on the left-hand side of the screen prints out when people complete the education course, and instead of printing off a registration number, it will print off a COR number instead.
The difference that participants will see is that they're going to have to go in and renew this every year, and so they'll just have to go in and retake the test each year. We keep the program as simple as possible. We are going to be waiving any fees that would generally be associated with a COR, and so this reduces and prevents any extra paperwork, and it also makes sense to do this because we don't want participants having to pay to get paid. The next recommendations we are proposing pertain to how samples come into us. So the first one, the current policy states throughout it that participants must have taken the animals that they are submitting. We are proposing to change the word taken with the word killed, and this is because there's a lot of ambiguity around the word taken. We are trying to eliminate having roadkill come into us as acceptable payment. And this is because roadkill isn't going to be beneficial to mule deer or other wildlife. And then on top of that, the word taken can also mean the word possess, which then makes it difficult for law enforcement to hold cases because you can understand taken as taken from another individual, or as long as it's in their possession, it was taken by them. And so we don't want participants doing that, and so this just helps law enforcement hold cases better. The next couple of things I have listed up there just pertain to how the scalp and lower jaw come into us at our check-in stations. We don't want to have maggots or other carrion organisms on them, and we don't want to have them rotten or spoiled. And this is because we need to have our biologists and technicians be able to confidently ID them as coyotes. And then the last thing, the current rule states that the jaw must include the canines, and we are just proposing to extend that out to the premolars because we actually collect a premolar tooth at check-in stations, and we've been doing that since the beginning of the program, so it just makes the rule match what our management actions are. The next recommendation we are proposing refers to having the ability to alter the payments that we pay out for each coyote, and this would be based on how close we came to exhausting our budget in the previous fiscal year. So the way it would work is we would decrease payments by $5 per coyote in following any fiscal year that we expended our entire allotted budget. And then in years that we stayed below the budget, we would increase at $5 up to the maximum of $50. So say this year we spent all of our money, we would then bump the payment down to $45 next fiscal year. And if we spent it all again, we would bump it down to $40. If we stayed below the budget, we bump it back up to $45 and then bump it back up to $50 if we again stayed below the budget. And this is really just a proactive approach to managing our budget because as the program continues, we are continuously seeing more and more coyotes turned in, which means we are paying out more and more money. And this hasn't been an issue yet, but it could potentially be an issue in the future because currently we've had rollover money from previous years to cover the extra money. However, we're coming closer and closer to exhausting our budget, and if we do that, the program has to immediately come to a halt until and if more funding becomes available. And then the last thing that's associated with this is we are recommending that participants must be required to submit their coyotes within 1 year of the kill date. And this would prevent participants from holding and storing up coyotes until, say, we have a year where payments are only worth $45. It keeps participants from holding on to them until we're back up to paying $50. And then we have this huge influx of payments to make, and then we exhaust our budget earlier in a fiscal year. The last recommendation we have is requiring the use of an electronic application to participate in the program. So the way the application would work is it will replace the paper compensation forms that participants are currently using. It will not replace the need to check in at designated check-in stations and still submit the scalp and lower jaw. So participants will be required to use a smartphone device which has location capabilities and image capturing, so a camera. And they will download the application onto their phone. When they're out in the field and they remove when they kill a coyote, they will go in, enter in the same information as they do on the paper compensation form, except they will no longer need to fill out the location data. So after they fill out the other stuff, it'll ask them to take a picture of the coyote. They will take a picture of the coyote, which will be geo-referenced, and then uploaded automatically to our database. If the participants are hunting in an area that doesn't have service, then the application will save that information, and when a participant goes home, they can later upload it to our database. The application is going to make submitting more efficient for participants because they are no longer going to have to figure out where they're hunting at. In my experience, most of our participants don't carry a GPS out in the field with them. What they're doing is they're going out, they're shooting their coyotes, they go back home. They have to either get on Google Maps or pull out a hard copy of a map and try to pinpoint down where they killed their coyotes at. And so this is going to completely eliminate that. And then additionally, it's going to increase our accuracy of the locations that we receive for the division. And on our end, it's going to make things much quicker and more efficient because our biologists and our technicians will no longer need to waste their time entering in all these data forms into our database because it'll automatically be saved for us. And then that's also going to reduce error because sometimes we have typos, and then on top of that, sometimes handwriting is really difficult to read or participants don't have a good understanding of how to record GPS locations. And then additionally, the application is intended to reduce fraud in the program. Currently, we have open cases in all five of our regions where participants are either suspected of or are being charged with turning in coyotes from out of state. And so this application is going to help reduce that issue. And then to piggyback onto this, the use of this application, we are recommending that we extend out our privacy protection policy. And currently, the policy protects trappers' trap lines from public disclosure at their request. However, we are proposing to extend that out to every participant who requests it so that their coyote removal locations won't be disclosed to the public under Utah Code 63G2-305. And this is really to help participants feel comfortable with giving us accurate GPS locations and using the application. And so you can see a map up on our left-hand corner, which shows exact locations of where every coyote that's been reported for fiscal year 2017 is posted on that map. And we provide that online in our annual reports. And so rather than doing that, we're going to be shifting to providing maps that are like density maps that's shown on the lower right, where it just shows hot spots of where lots of coyotes are being removed from versus cold spots where there's very few coyotes being removed from. Thank you, and I can take questions.
Thank you, Gila. Questions by the rec?
I've got one.
Yep.
On your coyote thing, the tribal members, you know, are we welcome to this?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, I know, because I know a lot of the guys would like to go out and take a lot of these coyotes. I know there was quite a few taken last year. But there's still a lot more out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're absolutely included. As long as they are able to use the smartphones and take their education courses, then they qualify to participate.
Okay. They still have to get on the smartphone and
Yep.
do it that way.
So that won't be... We're proposing to make that a requirement in 2019. So for the next year, it'll be a trial run. So both the paper compensation forms and the electronic application will become available. So it's... be either one for the next year.
Okay.
Other questions? Daniel?
The controlling aspect for the coyote population, since we've went to the bounty versus the alternative methods, flight harvest, government trappers, how is the take numbers in balance or in ratio to one another? Is the bounty surpassing what we were doing before? Are we kind of equal?
So I don't know the specific numbers off the top of my head, but I do know on average we are removing more coyotes since the bounty has started than we were prior to 2012, which is when it was initiated. We still do have Wildlife Services doing aerial gunning and other take methods, so in conjunction with the bounty.
Okay.
Yep.
So across the state, throughout the other regions, how has it been, received with, because basically the app would require a smartphone, right? So a lot of people have smartphones. Not everybody does. Has there been concern from the other regions about what?
So it has been addressed in, I believe, 3 of the 4 other regions. And it was the recommendation was passed in all of the regions, and so it was addressed, but it wasn't like the top priority concern in most of them. So
I can understand the fraud part of it, just because of, I think it'd be pretty easy to put some in your freezer for a while and tell the division they took it in one spot when they really didn't take it there. And I can understand how this would eliminate any of that.
And hope that it expands to other species harvest as well.
Other questions by the rack? Okay, questions by the public? Any questions? Okay, we're going to go to comments.
Thank you.
Kevin
Norman, representing SFW. We support the division's recommendations on this. Also on a represent myself, addressing the concern, I've been to all the racks as well on the smartphone, and I believe that it's a tool. People are making money doing this. You're going to build a house, you have to have a saw. So anyone can go harvest coyotes, but in order to make the money, it's a requirement that I think's legitimate. So thanks.
Thank you, Kevin. Any other comments? So we need a card. All right, Buck.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to compliment you. I think it's very well done.
Thank you.
Okay, back to the rack for discussion. Any concerns other than the smartphone?
Well, I think nowadays that even if somebody, an older person, doesn't have a smartphone, they have access to a younger family member who does. So I think it's a worker.
You got a teenager with them, huh?
Yeah.
And it's a good deal for the DWR and for the sportsman, but we're still paying $50 for a coyote. So the fact that they have to do a little bit of data gathering, I don't think that should be objectionable.
Other discussion? Okay, I'll entertain a motion.
I would make a motion, Mr. Chairman, that we accept the recommendation as presented.
That was Brett made a motion to accept it as presented. Do we have a second?
I'll second the motion.
Okay, thank you. Natasha seconds that. Further discussion? Okay, I'll call for vote. All those in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. It's unanimous. Yeah, I thought there was only 7 of us. Thank you, Jayla. All right, next up is another action item. It's the Mineral Mountain Bighorn Sheep Management Plan. David Smedley, wildlife biologist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Like you said, I'm David Smedley. I'm a biologist out of the southern region. I'm in Miller and Beaver County. And here to present our Mineral Mountain Desert Bighorn Sheep Plan. And give you kind of a little background of this. So bighorn sheep were once really abundant throughout the western United States. At one point, desert bighorn sheep were estimated to be 1.5 to 2 million bighorn sheep throughout the western United States. But by the late 1800s, those numbers were less than 5% of what they had been. And even in Utah, they were the most abundant ungulate we had in Utah. But they were, like throughout the rest of the United States there, they were extirpated from all their native ranges here in Utah, except for like the canyon lions. So as an agency, we look for these opportunities we have to reestablish these animals that have crashed, that their populations weren't once what they were, but to be able to have an opportunity to establish them to some of their native ranges. So as we looked at the Mineral Mountains, you know, we know desert bighorn sheep were native to Beaver County, and the Mineral Mountains were a great place. They don't have any domestic sheep allotment or sheep allotments on the unit. And so it looked like a great opportunity where we can expand, provide another opportunity to have another population of bighorn sheep. So we took that plan and idea, and we first met with the Beaver County commissioners. And from that meeting, we came out with support and interest in pursuing that and to have bighorn sheep up on the Mineral Mountains. And we've coordinated with the BLM through this entire process, and we've worked with them a lot. They've been very supportive. They wrote a letter for the Southern Rack that discussed that they're excited to be a partner in restoring these bighorn sheep to the minerals. Then we've gone and met with the permittees. So we took a draft of the plan. We took it to the permittees that would be on the unit and affected, and let them give input and concerns. And we've addressed a lot of those concerns. And some of those concerns we're able to address now. Some of those concerns are hypothetical, and it's hard to address those concerns that haven't come up yet. It's not something that we're just going to put sheep out and be done. But we want to continue to work with these people, with the local stakeholders. And we've done that in other places. So as issues come up, like when we put mountain goats on the Dutton, we had a working group that goes out and meets annually. So we've got over a dozen bighorn units in the state with cattle, and there hasn't been issues there. We don't expect there to be an issue here between the sheep and the cattle, but we're willing to go through and work continually with these stakeholders and the permittees and talk through any issues that may arise. But as we updated those plans, we took the updated plan that we had from the meetings that we had, and we took it again to the Beaver and Millard County Commissioners. So most of the minerals is located in Beaver County. A little part on the north end is in Millard County. But we took this plan to both. They didn't take an official vote, but from both of those meetings, we had verbal support from them. And then once again, we met again with the local permittees and stakeholders and have continued to try to work through some of those issues and concerns that they have. So kind of give you an idea, Mineral Mountains is located. They're east, west of Beaver and east of Milford. They're in Beaver County. So the Mineral Mountain Range, one of the things we looked at is suitable habitat. So we modeled over 100,000 acres of suitable habitat. Majority of that is found on private land. And so this, the land ownership map here is specifically within that suitable habitat. So as you look at the unit wide, there is the distribution is a little different. There's 25% private land in the unit, but within the available habitat for the bighorns, there's 4% private and like 95% public. So it's a great opportunity with a lot of space for those sheep to go. And then here's a map just of that modeled habitat. So the black line is the proposed unit boundary. Habitat's right up the middle along the mountain range. And then that blue star is our potential release site where we'd like to start that initial population near Granite Peak. So as I continue to go through this plan, this is just how our management plan flows as it goes through this PowerPoint. It goes step by step through the management plan. But, you know, the first thing, we want to manage for a healthy population of bighorn sheep. We want to balance those impacts they have with other uses, such as cattle grazing and the local economies, and then maintain a population that's sustainable within the available habitat in the unit. So some of the issues and concerns that we address in the plan is potential habitat. So one of the first things we discuss, we realize there's a lot of habitat available there currently, but there's still opportunities to improve that habitat that we can further increase the amount of habitat that's available. We discuss livestock competition. There's been little dietary overlap between desert bighorns and cattle found. Typically, sheep avoid areas with cattle, and that's kind of one of the reasons that we haven't found this to be an issue throughout the units that we have sheep and cattle that coexist, because they avoid those areas. And then they select for steep, rough, rocky, nasty terrain that aren't typically used by cattle. And then desert bighorn also have minimum water requirements. The next issue we addressed is disease. That's obviously a concern with any bighorn sheep unit. So spatial separation is always a key factor there. And then predation. Cougars will be most likely to be the main predator there for bighorn sheep on the unit. Our population management objective, like to achieve and maintain a population of 175 desert bighorn sheep. Our strategies to do this, we'll first start with an initial transplant of a minimum of 40 desert bighorn sheep, and those will likely come from Zion or the Muddy Mountains, depending on timing and the source herd availability. And then from that, we'll monitor those sheep. So we'll put GPS collars on a lot of them. We can follow their movements, survival, and then we can use area monitoring as well every 2 to 3 years to survey the population and ground classification to continue to monitor how well that population's doing. And then predator management, before we transplant any animals, we'll go through and try to remove some of those predators with wildlife services. Our disease management objectives, we want to maintain a healthy population of bighorn sheep on the minerals and maintain spatial separation from domestic sheep and goats. So the disease, our strategies for this, we'll first initially test the source herd, and then we'll use opportunistic testing once those sheep are on the ground to continue to monitor the health of that herd. Spatial separation, identify areas of risk, and monitor where those sheep go. And if we need to go out and remove bighorns, we can do that, and we have done that. And we don't want that to be a concern. If it's really in our best interest, as those concerns come up, to go out and remove those sheep if necessary, so they don't bring back disease to a clean herd. And then we've looked at potential fencing as another possibility if needed to help prevent any commingling there. Our habitat management objectives, we want to maintain and improve the sufficient bighorn sheep habitat to help achieve that population. And we want to support and encourage livestock grazing still. We like to see it there, and it's a great place where they can continue to coexist there, and then maintain the forage production and help improve what's currently there through habitat projects, as well as water availability where possible. So our strategies for this, I like to monitor habitat quantity and quality on an annual basis and see what they're using there, and then habitat improvement and water improvement. So these projects that are listed here have come up as a result of those conversations with the BLM and with the permittees, and that these are areas and with the division that we feel we can go in and make a difference. We can improve the habitat and expand water throughout these areas. Our recreation management objectives, we like to provide hunting opportunities in accordance with the statewide plan and increase public awareness and expand viewing opportunities for bighorn sheep. So once again, hunting, our strategies for this, we'll recommend all those permits in accordance with the statewide plan. And then we can use U-hunts as needed as well to help maintain that population. And then viewing opportunities, we'd like to increase awareness and expand viewing opportunities. And this is, we like to hunt, but it's a great opportunity for hunters. It's a huge demand. There's thousands of people, over 23,000 people that put in for desert bighorn sheep. And we give out a few permits, so there's few people that get to go out and hunt these animals, but we're excited for the opportunity to expand the public awareness and expand viewing opportunities. Because like I said, historically they're one of the most abundant animal in Utah. They were important culturally. Many of the Native American tribes used them as a food source. They were a sacred symbol. They're abundant in the artwork found throughout Utah and throughout the West. And so it's a really big deal for people that don't hunt or don't get the opportunity that want to go out and see these animals in their habitat. So we're excited to have another opportunity to put animals out on the landscape where people can go enjoy seeing these magnificent creatures. Public involvement, we talked about this a little earlier, but we'd like to provide those opportunities for the local stakeholders and agencies to be involved with our management process. And we've tried to do that throughout this process to reach out and communicate with them. And so as we go forward, any plan revisions or components of the plan that need to be revised, we'll work with these agencies and local stakeholders and the permittees in that decision-making process as this goes forward. Our timeline, we'd propose that this could happen as early as this fall, depending on the source herd availability. So with that, I'll take any questions you have. That's all we have for the plan.
Thank you, David. I think we've probably all had a chance to to review the, I know the Utah Wool Growers Association sent us an email and kind of opposed to this, but I don't know that everybody here got a chance to review the letter the county, Beaver County, sent out today from Kevin Wicker. Have you had a chance to review that letter?
I have not read that letter.
Okay, I'd like to read it and maybe just get your...
I haven't read. I think Justin has, but...
Okay. Just so I don't know that... Wade just got this afternoon, so I don't know if everybody had a chance. So I'd like to just go ahead and read it so that... And maybe some of the points you can address as we go through. But this is written to the on May 10th, 2018, to the Northeastern Region RAC meeting. It says the Beaver County Commission, fundamentally speaking, is not opposed to the introduction of bighorn sheep on Mineral Mountains. However, there was no vote taken or official declaration given by the commission in support of this action. Until the primary stakeholders involved can come to an agreement and resolve some vital issues, the commission will withhold full support. We hope all parties can work together to find solutions for sharing this habitat. We would encourage the continued use of local working group to bring stakeholders together to find solutions to numerous concerns that have been raised. When this bighorn sheep transplant was announced, there was a public open house held to inform the local community. This was followed by a working group meeting in which select stakeholders were invited to come together to resolve issues and concerns. In both of these meetings, the DWR made numerous verbal promises and assurances that every precaution would be taken to protect the grazing rights of the livestock permittees. Wild sheep, it was promised, would not impact nearby domestic sheep ranching activities. The DWR has insisted they would be liable for any wild/domestic sheep interactions. Any problems resulting from the bighorn sheep transplant would be immediately mitigated by the DWR to the extent that, if necessary, the sheep would be removed. We'd like to know with certainty that all these promises and assurances have been fully addressed in the bighorn sheep management plan. And I think they are, but is that true? Are those issues addressed in the plan?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember everything you said there, but we've addressed most of those issues in that plan. So we will are, like, as sheep go out and if they come in contact with domestics or they get close, we are very willing to go out and remove those sheep. So we are committed to that because it's in our best interest to keep that herd clean and not let those sheep that wander and come close to domestics come back. And we've got a track record. We've done that throughout the state as sheep go out and wander, which can happen. And throughout the state, we've in several cases, we've gone out and removed those bighorn.
Okay, and then it says, number three, nearly all the water developments on the mountain belong to the local livestock permittees. We believe that when there is a new water development planned that has the potential to benefit the bighorn sheep, the DWR should become involved in these projects, either in participating in construction or with funding help.
And some of those water, like we have a list there in that plan, and that's in the management plan. Like we're very willing to help with those water projects, and we're willing. We looked at guzzlers too to put more water sources on top for bighorns as well. So it's not just coming off their pipelines and springs, but we'll help improve those water availability sources for those.
Okay, and then number four says we need the assurance that any sheep that strays from the core area within the Mineral Mountains identified as a bighorn sheep habitat, not the unit boundary, will be immediately removed by whatever means necessary. The land surrounding this mountain are extensively privately owned with historic domestic sheep ranching activities. Current domestic sheep herd trailing routes pass by the northern end of the mountain range. The potential for conflict is very real and concerns over the backlash of having domestic sheep causing a widespread die-off in the bighorn sheep population are substantial. And I think you've already addressed that. Number five, bighorn sheep populations must be held firmly to the herd unit objective of 175 animals as written. The time to act is not when the unit is 20% over objective, but when the population is approaching that objective. And I think you guys are committed to that. Bighorn sheep are a rare and valuable treasure. They generate huge sums of money for the opportunity to hunt them with special permits. That money generated from those permit sales should go primarily back into protecting and improving their habitat. Is that, Justin, you want to comment on that one?
I do, because if you keep reading, Justin Shannon, Wildlife Section Chief, is that better?
Yeah.
And you got to get close to this mic. Very intimate moment here. The next line on this says that the money generated from those permit sales must go back into the protecting and improving their habitat, not into somebody's budget, not into someone's budget. Bighorn sheep is one where the Division of Wildlife, we don't necessarily make money off bighorn sheep. The number of permits that we issue and the conservation permit money that is generated from those sales, that does not come close to funding the surveys, the monitoring, the transplant work, all those types of things that we've talked about. So it's not being stored in some account that's just getting banked. That money does go back into active management for monitoring, habitat restoration, guzzlers, those types of management activities. So that one does need some clarification.
Thank you. That last line you read, yes. It's not in the letter they sent us.
Okay.
ours ends with into protecting and improving their habitat.
It was last night, and that was, so pardon for bringing it up.
Okay. And then number seven, it says the Southern Rack Board on May 8th voted 7-2 to table this proposal until stakeholders involved had time to work together to resolve conflicts. And that was submitted by a Kevin Wicker, Beaver County National Resource Specialist. So I just want to make, I thought it was fair that, I don't know that all of the RAC members had a chance to review that beforehand. So, all right, questions by the RAC?
I got one. So, forgive me, I haven't seen the unit boundaries looked up, but in correlation to, say, the big game as far as deer and elk, what unit would that be?
It's on the Beaver West unit. It's west I-15, and then it goes up the Black Rock Road and then down Minersville Highway there. Cuts across through, or to Milford, I mean, and then cuts across through Minersville into I-15 and Beaver and back up.
Okay.
I've got a question. So was it your understanding that Beaver County did support the plan?
Right. During those conversations, yes. They expressed verbal support during those conversations. And then it's, since that time, just recently, it's been some new things that come up, so.
Okay.
So the RAC... There was a lot of opposition on the RAC, Southern RAC.
So on the RAC themselves, there wasn't necessarily opposition. A lot of them would like to see some other issues worked through that they felt hadn't been worked through there. So, like to see more people in agreement there.
Chair, I've got a question.
from the unit boundary, the proposed unit boundary, how far away are the nearest domestic sheep?
So the closest one would probably be, I'll show you, right, let me go back to this. So right there on the south end of that boundary is it's the Greenville Bench Allotment. That would be the closest potential.
Is there a laser?
It's not working.
But it's just below.
Are you talking south of Minersville?
South of Minersville Reservoir, which is the reservoir down there. That's the Greenville Bench. So you're, but currently, there we go, there's the Greenville Bench. So right down here. Currently they run cattle. They do have the option to run sheep, so that could be a potential in the future. The next closest one is just west of Milford. So you've got one like 5 to 6 miles west of Milford. So it's a pretty long ways across a desert grassland. And then there's one sheep allotment right up here on the north. It's through Ensign Ranches owns that allotment, but they're in the cattle business, and so they're going through an application process right now to get rid of that sheep and convert to cattle, and so that one will no longer exist within the next few years.
What's the ranging distance on a bighorn sheep, particularly a ram?
All right, Jace, you want to answer that?
Sure. See if I have to get this close, huh?
Turn the little knob on the side.
No, this down, the down, long down. One. The long dangling one right here?
Yep. There you go. Loosen it.
Oh.
No. There you go.
There we go.
Troy will thank you later.
You're going to have to hang directions.
Thank you. I'm Jay Staler, EWR wildlife biologist, but specifically for bighorn sheep for the state. So it's very variable, especially when you talk about historically versus present day. Historically, bighorn sheep, like Dave mentioned, were really common throughout the state. And so they, because the densities were much higher, they were more apt to spread. But with the low densities that we have right now, especially a situation like this, that modeled habitat is 100,000 acres of suitable habitat. We're talking about 175 bighorn sheep. And we're doing that on purpose, trying to keep a very low number, one sheep per 600 acres, so that they will remain in the most rugged and steep habitat. This place has some really nasty stuff that doesn't get used by hardly anything. And so by keeping the numbers low, we can keep those animals there and hopefully limit their tendency to wander. But as far as the number goes, you know, there's been records of bighorn sheep wandering, you know, many miles, you know, 40, 50 miles, whatever it is. We don't normally see that because we keep our densities low. It's hard to say, but we'll do what we can to keep them low.
So how many miles has your GPS data shown?
Variable. We have populations, so maybe the closest population, so take the Oak Creek population. Those animals that we released there, 3 miles. I mean, most of those animals aren't going anywhere. Another situation where we have lower densities. Some of the other ones, the Newfoundland Mountains, we haven't had an animal leave the Newfoundland Mountains. We have the Stansberry unit where we have collars. We've had a really hard time getting those animals to spread as well. They've stayed very much on the north end, just right where we've released them. Some of our Wasatch Front ones, we've also had really hard times. Just the first canyon we released them in. Some of these ones up here, so looking up here in North Slope, some of these animals are probably our greatest distances that they've moved. I think that the most we've had animals move up here has been 30 miles. A different situation where they have very distinct, very high summer ranges and then lower winter ranges. So like from Mirror Lake all the way up to like Gilbert Peak, those kind of things. And so that's a little bit of a different situation. Down here, desert bighorn sheep, where we don't get the snowpack on their summer range, lower movements.
Thank you.
Other questions, Brother Rock? Dan? Yeah.
So in the southern region, they voted 7-2 to table this. Is that correct?
Correct.
What about the other regions?
So the central and the northern region, it passed unanimously, and then also passed in the southeastern region last night.
How did it pass in the southeastern region?
It was 6-5. Is that correct?
The chairman didn't have to break that, did he?
Yes. The chairman
he did.
Yes,
he did.
She did.
Oh, she did?
Yes.
She. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Don't do it to me.
Can I ask another question? Anybody that's involved in this management plan, did Bill Bates in the last couple months talk to you at all about a conversation him and I had and some ideas we had to mitigate these concerns of the county and the sheep and cattlemen and other industries in that area? We had had a discussion at a public lands meeting orchestrated by the governor's public land office. He presented some ideas that would maybe mitigate these. I had some ideas. I asked him to present that to the concerned parties, but from the letters I got, I don't know if they were presented the options him and I talked about, and I can't get a hold of Bill. Apparently he's indisposed till next week, but I just don't know where our conversation went. I guess I'm a little disappointed that these issues are still kind of on the table.
I've spoken with Bill about this, and we've got a meeting scheduled. Well, we met with PLIPCO recently talking about forming a potential MOU to address these types of issues, not just for the minerals, but big picture when it comes to the division and bighorn sheep and domestic sheep and the stakeholders that are involved. Because there are some conflicts that could arise when it comes to these things because of the disease issues. And so we've met with PLIPCO. We've got another meeting scheduled here at the end of the month with them. We're making progress on that. And if that didn't get communicated back to you, we apologize for that. But it's been in the works. So.
is there a reason some of those MOUs couldn't have been already in place? There's precedent for those MOUs in other areas and other species that mitigated a lot of these issues. Is there a reason they can't be in place now?
I mean, you look at how Utah's managed bighorn sheep. Our statewide plan is really clear. As a wildlife agency, we want to restore native bighorn sheep to the landscape. That's something we're really interested in. But in our management plan, we say we don't want to do it at the expense of the domestic sheep industry. We've been very clear about that. And some of the things that would want to be seen in these types of MOUs are things like, can the division support the domestic sheep industry and try to help them thrive and be successful and still have bighorn sheep, not get into this win-lose situation, but try to identify where we can support each other and where we can have populations of bighorn restored. And so that a unit like the minerals, where we don't have domestic sheep, this is one that kind of makes sense for us. And one thing that I wanted to highlight this is we're all familiar with the bighorn sheep issues on the north slope of the Uintah right now. I mean, that's an area that has bighorn sheep. It has domestic sheep conflicts and a lot of discussion there. And I think a lot of the conversation we heard about in the southern region came from that. 2 weeks ago, we sent a letter to the Forest Service, and it read this. It says, the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources supports authorization of the domestic sheep allotments under consideration. This population of bighorn sheep has coexisted with domestic sheep in proximity to their occupied habitat for nearly 30 years, and our agency has successfully managed a sustainable population of wild sheep during that time. And so we haven't had a formal MOU per se, but our philosophy has been we want to have bighorn sheep, but not at the expense of the domestic sheep industry. I can't think of a time where we put bighorn sheep on the landscape and forced a permittee off that wasn't willing to be compensated for it.
So. My concern's not with the DWR or with the Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife.
Sure.
Forcing. Do you know who my concern is with?
I don't.
Okay. It's, and I can save this to the comment period, I guess, but our concerns with other radical groups that use wildlife species as purpose for litigation to diminish other industries. It happens every day. It's the MO, it's the operating thing they use to curtail oil, gas, mining, agriculture. The DWR is not going to sue to remove the sheep, the domestic sheep or cattle. I know that. The Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife are not going to sue to remove domestic sheep and cattle. We're arguing the wrong argument. And my conversation with Bill Bates was that, and I've had conversations with some of these local people down there, and I said, look, what is your concern? Primarily, their concern is not the bighorn sheep. And it's not the DWR suing them. It's not the Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife suing them. It's the door that it opens for other groups, radical groups, I won't mention their names, but you guys know who they are, that continually use wildlife species to sue at the detriment of other industry. And so Bill and I felt like had some good ideas that had been precedented and used in other areas to curtail those concerns. I felt like there's no reason that those MOUs shouldn't have already been in place. They benefit the wildlife. It moves the process forward. I was plenty willing to support this plan. It moved. I guess my question is, if we know that these concerns could have been mitigated with MOUs, why aren't the MOUs in place? I did my due diligence under what Mr. Bushman talked about, under what the RAC members' purpose are. I gathered information. I presented solutions. And when I presented those solutions to these folks, they said, that's a great solution, but we've never been presented that. So I guess my question is, why?
I don't know if I have a good answer as to why it hasn't been done, but just know we're working on it. We've had the conversations. We have more meetings ahead. So
okay.
It probably doesn't do justice, Richie, to what you're asking for, and I don't have a good answer for you, but it's something we're focused on. And I think your concern has some validity when you talk about is domestic sheep grazing under attack on Utah's landscape and in the West. It is, and what I would offer is by reading this letter and doing some of these things, it's not because we would sue, it's because we're trying to be a good partner, and that's what I wanted to highlight.
I appreciate that, and I want to make clear that I understand that, and Troy and I we'd like to have had a longer conversation prior to this meeting, but he and I understand that. We're not too worried about each other. We're worried about opening the door for others that could hurt us both. And I'll save the rest for the comment.
How long ago was your meeting with Bill?
Oh, I talked to the governor's office this morning. I believe it was in February.
Yeah.
A couple months.
Certainly. Knowing Bill, I know that he's not going to just shirk it.
And like I say, he may have done. Yes, he may have done more than I realize. I can't get a hold of him, so I can't ask him myself.
He's out of town.
So
I'll give you a cell number after the meeting. I
appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Richie. Other discussion, or other questions? Not hearing any questions by the public. Troy? you got it.
There we go. Troy Justinson, Sportsman Fish and Wildlife. I guess my question to you is, the thing you read from the county commissioners, is that the first or the second draft? There's two.
It's the only one I got.
It's the second one if you got it today. I'll comment on that a little bit later. It's kind of interesting how that came about. My other question is dealing with MOUs. Has any of them ever been tried in court? Do they work?
The MOUs that I'm familiar with have not been tried in court. No, they haven't. They don't leave a lot of room for that because of what Mr. Bushman talked about and the division's responsibility for wildlife in his state. There's not a lot of wiggle room that if the division decides they're going to remove something or whatnot, that they can't do it. I think it would be very hard for some of these groups to sue and tell the division they can't do it because it's so explicit in the legislative law that, to my knowledge, maybe Mr. Bushman can answer better, but to my knowledge, none of the MOUs have been tried.
I'm not aware of any that have been
litigated. All right. Next question. Daniel, is there any units, say recently, that we put sheep on that are similar, have similar circumstances of what we're looking at here on the minerals?
Like that we've put sheep recently?
Correct. Some of the same issues and concerns here that be similar.
So, yeah, to the north, the Oak Creek unit, a lot of these concerns came up, and that's on the Forest Service boundary. And the Forest Service guy said this at the RAC too, but those concerns, we put sheep on there in 2014, and none of those concerns that came up have been an issue. So those bighorns, they're staying in place, they're up high, and there really hasn't been any of those concerns that have become a problem.
Now, similar list unit too, they also have a sheep producer that trails through, correct?
Correct.
Hasn't been an issue?
It hasn't.
Yeah. Then Richie, let me make sure I understand you. Did you ask that you're concerned or else the industry is concerned that Sports and Fish and Wildlife would sue?
No.
Okay,
I couldn't hear. We are not concerned.
Let me put you at ease here. The only time we'd sue is to stand on your side to keep you on the range.
Well, that exactly, and I want to make that clear. We are not concerned about the DWR or the Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, the sportsmen's group suing us. You guys are not our concern. I've never known of a case of that happening. So, no, you guys are not our concern.
As long as I have the reins, that ain't happening. So, rest at ease. Thank you.
Thank you, Troy. Other questions? Cheryl, is this a question or a comment?
Because
Okay, I, we're not. It's not. It's just questions now.
Oh, right.
I'll hang on to your card.
Give it back to me.
All right. Can't have it. Sorry.
Once I gave it to you, that's done.
That's done. All right. Other questions? Oh, yeah, now they come out of the woodwork. Thank you, Justin. Any other? Well,
can I ask another
question? We're still in the question period.
Your question.
Yep.
If an item is tabled, an agenda or an action item is tabled, can that come back to the RAC in a short amount of time? Say, can it come back to the RAC agenda within 30 days, 60 days, 90 days?
Our RAC meetings are scheduled out, and unless it's an emergency, we have had an emergency where they've had to call, and we've had call-ins. It takes a lot of work. You may be able to get it back on to the agenda for July? Could somebody? Yeah.
So we could still get it on for July, August, if an item was tabled.
Oh, that's a possibility,
but
yes.
But the fact
that the Wildlife Board would have to table it.
Yeah.
We don't have to.
Because this is going to go to the Wildlife Board.
Right.
Anyways, and they have the opportunity to say, well, we tried, and they can accept it anyways, or they can say, okay, let's come back in July.
Okay.
But it's them that'll have to make
that was
final
just what
decision.
I just want to know if this thing gets tabled, do we have to go through this stuff and for a whole nother year before it can come back up? But that is not the case.
No, I don't think so. I believe if the board deems it necessary, it'll be July or sometime now.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
But the board could just approve it.
Or the board could just approve it, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
If I may, to clarify, tonight we're either approving it or not approving it, and if it's not approved and you want to table it, you can do that in addition to not approving it, but I don't think there's a process that says a yay or nay or neutral. I think it's no with the ability to table, bring it back to the racks. So.
Other questions?
Good point.
All right, we're going to go to comment period, and we're going to have Cheryl come up first. She was joining on the spot and got hers up here. So if you would,
sorry, I wasn't aware of your procedure.
State your name and provide your comment.
Perfect. My name is Cheryl Meyer. I'm the UNA County Public Lands Specialist. I spoke with Brad Horrocks today, and he apologizes for not being able to be here, but he also received that letter from Beaver County Commission, and UNA County has some of the same concerns that he kind of addressed with me. What I would like is some time to mitigate those concerns from the public or from the county. We're not opposed to this plan, but I would like to ask that you do table it for those considerations to kind of lessen the concerns that have been brought up today and that will be brought up. That's what I have. Okay.
Thank you. Kevin Norman, and after that will be Garrick Hall.
Kevin Norman, representing myself. I support this wholeheartedly to put sheep on the Mineral Mountains. I'm an avid sportsman myself, and sheep hunting's kind of been a rich man's game, and this just affords more opportunity for the average Joe like myself to have an opportunity hunting these creatures. Also, one of the things I'd like to elaborate a little bit on the Oak Creeks. The gentleman from the Forest Service also, with all the what-ifs that have been brought up by the grazers, that none of them have come to fruition. But in return, there's been a substantial amount of funding come to that mountain on behalf of the sheep being there. There's a lot of funding out there. Sheep are a sacred animal, and there's been an abundance of additional funding come to that range because the sheep are there that has benefited everybody on that mountain. The other thing is the fact that the collared bighorns on that mountain have basically t- totally stay within a 3-mile radius. That was shocking to me and a neat deal. So anyways, with that being said, I support this this action by the division. I think they're being proactive for everybody involved, and I support that. Thanks.
Thank you, Kevin. Garrick, next, and after that will be Vance Merrill.
So I'm Garrick Hall, up here representing Utah Farm Bureau. Garrick Hall. I appreciate reading the letter from Beaver County and their comments. I was in that rack on Tuesday. Seems like a long time ago because it was a late night that night. We've had several late nights this week. I also appreciate what Richie has talked about maybe having some MOUs, some ways to mitigate some of the concerns that were brought up. You know, Tuesday night we had a discussion that lasted 2.5 or 3 hours just on this topic with a number of concerns that were raised. And I'll agree, some of those concerns are probably not even legitimate concerns, but there were some legitimate concerns that were brought up. There are sheep that trail through this area. There are domestic sheep that reside within the hunting boundaries, not on the habitat area, but within that unit boundaries. There are some concerns that I think can be mitigated and worked through if given the time to do that. So our ask from Utah Farm Bureau would be that you table this issue or recommend tabling it long enough to work through those issues with the private landowners that are there in the area, issues with the permittees, issues with all interested parties. And let's try to work through some of these issues before we put the sheep on the mountain rather than put them up there and then try to work it out after the fact. So thank you.
Thank you, Garrick. Vance Merrill and then Greg Bird.
I'm Vance Merrill. I'm a member of the Yuna County Cattlemen's Association, and we've got a lot of the same concerns that he just voiced about negative impacts to livestock grazing. I don't know what other industries are on that mountain, but get these things addressed before sheep go up there so there's a way to manage things. Back up and get these things addressed and then move on with it would be the way we'd like to see things go.
Okay. Thank you, Vance. Greg Bird and then Troy Justinson.
Greg Bird, Utah Wild Sheep Foundation. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before the panel tonight. And I've been in all these RAC meetings also, and there's been some concerns. And as the Wild Sheep Foundation, we recognize there are some legitimate concerns. We approve and accept the proposal as presented by the division. We feel like they have a sound management plan, and they've done a great job presenting it tonight as they have everywhere else in the state. We're excited for this new sheep herd.
Can you talk a little bit closer to that mic?
Yeah, we're excited for this new sheep herd. Possibility of it. I mean, desert sheep has been stated already. They're a precious animal. They're a resource that not many states have. And we have the opportunity right now to, you know, reintroduce sheep on this range. I mean, it has been brought up that they're not native, and that's subjective. And they've been everywhere else. It's probably naive to say that they didn't walk on that piece of dirt. One thing we can say is the cattle and the sheep are not native. I mean, so that argument, I mean, it's just kind of a moot point to me. They're native, they're not native, I mean, whatever. We feel like we can all work together on this. There's plenty of habitat on that mountain for both. One thing is the Sheep Foundation is we have never asked permittees to leave. As Justin stated, there's been permittees that have transferred their sheep AUMs to cattle, but they've been compensated for it, and they wanted to do it, and they were willing partners. We want partners on the mountain. And some of these concerns by the Grazers Association, we've met with them 3 times. We've driven down there in the last 6 months and talked to them. Numerous conversations over the phone and emails. One of their big hang-ups was they want a NEPA on that. We're not going to do that. We don't want to turn over our wildlife management to the federal government. That's just ridiculous. And I don't know why they'd want that either. But, you know, this mountain is perfect for desert sheep. And it's been brought up that there's a big, you know, portion of private land on it. Well, the private land is in these big white flats around here. and there's 4% or less on the mountain itself. And with those concerns, we've talked with the grazers, and the two grazers that are on that mountain were in agreement with Ensign Ranches that they're going to convert to cattle. And the North Divide group, we've met and met and met. And their big sticking point is that NEPA. Between the grazers on the North Divide and Ensign Ranches, we've committed over $371,000 in range habitat improvement and water projects just for them to do something they're not currently doing or have not done in the past 100 years, and in their own words, will never do. They're cattle ranchers. They're not sheep ranchers. So we've compensated them for the possibility of just, we want to be partners, and we don't want just to, you know, shove the sheep down their throat. But there's room for both. We need to keep in mind this is public land. A huge portion of this is public land. The grazers are not the only people to make a living on this mountain. There's a lot of guides and outfitters down in that particular county that make their livings doing this also. It affects them also. So we just ask you to take this into consideration, and I would urge you to vote on it tonight. This time, this has been several years in the process. We tabled it last year because we could run it through the process differently. And then while we tabled it, not running it through the racks last year, we lost the opportunity for 75 desert bighorn sheep from Nevada. And we run the risk of doing that again if we delay this. If we run it back to July again, we're going to lose that opportunity with Nevada to take these sheep again. And then once that resource is gone, there's just not desert sheep just around every corner that we can use as source herds. So I appreciate your time, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate it. Troy Justison, he's the last one. Does anybody else like to comment on this? Please get us your card.
Troy Justison, Sports, Fish, and Wildlife. I want to clarify a couple of things, though. I want to give you a history of the racks. As I mentioned, the central and the northern pretty much passed it unanimous. In the southern region, it was 5-4 on this and to not approve it. And then what was the 7-2 vote was actually to table it. We're missing four RAC members, three of which I guarantee you are a yes vote. We're not having that conversation today if those three are there. It's 4-0. It was a win by technicality. It is what it is, but that's just stating the facts. I think it's important when you try and get the right answer to anything is you state the facts and you don't base it off emotion. One thing I've learned in 20 years of attending these meetings is you come in here, you can tell who's going to vote which way. We all do it. You're going to vote your side. Sports are going to vote your side. So really who I'm talking to is you guys that don't have an interest in it, that I hope you can look at it objectively and think it out in your mind and say, hey, what's right? What makes the most sense? The first happened the other night, too, is the first time I've been accosted by a 70-year-old man. As I stood down the southern rack and voiced my opinion, I had one of the producers come up to me and try and drive his finger through my chest. The third time I warned him, hey, we're going to go to the ground if you don't quit it. So that was quite interesting. So, but anyway.
Did he get the point?
I think he did. But anyway, Sportsman Fish and Wildlife supports this recommendation. As it's been mentioned before, there is nothing, the issues are brought up that we haven't faced before. Almost every sheep unit in the state has these same type of conflicts. It's the same type of conflicts. And we've managed to work together. And we have a great herd for consumptive and consumptive users to enjoy. We are committed to working with livestock producers. We're not trying to force anybody off. I'm a little bit upset about the letter that came from the commission. This is round two. The first round was not sent to you. This is a round they put together after we jumped down their throats a little bit because they took a couple of shots over the vow, and this letter was not supposed to release. It was been released by one zealous county commissioner. The same county commissioner, Tammy, I'm going to tell you her name, attended our banquet. And I sat down and talked with her, and I says, Tammy, I'm a little bit frustrated. You know, it's been mentioned tonight here that, hey, you guys need to go work out these agreements. As Greg's been talking, we've been working for 6 months with the North Divide to come to an agreement. I says, Tammy, I'm frustrated. I know you have some ends here. This is what's been offered. This is what we've been working through. What's the problem? Her exact words to me is, Troy, I don't know. I told them they need to accept it. This would be a great thing to have there. The problem is she keeps forgetting what side of her mouth she's talking out. That bothers me. She's a good person. But when a person doesn't honor their word, I have an issue with it. The other thing it talked about, it goes to the end of there, and Justin read that paragraph. It talks about the money that's generated from these things. They made the innuendo that the only reason that we're pushing these things is this money goes in our pockets. That's the biggest crock of BS I've ever heard in my life. You've seen a slide there that talked about $181 million. That's where the money goes. Anybody in a public position of government needs to at least study the facts and understand what they're talking about. And anybody that's familiar with the conservation permit rule knows that only 10% goes back to the group. 30% the division keeps, 60% the group gets to influence where it goes. It all has to go back into big game. That's why we can generate 180 some odd million dollars to put back on the ground to benefit all users. Remember, this is multiple use. That was unfair. Obviously, I seen this in last draft. That was redacted. Amazing. Bottom line is this. We've tried. We tried a year ago. We've sat down. North Divide grazers have drawn a line in the sand and says, if you're not willing to do a NEPA, we're at the end. I'll tell you what the offer was to them. There is no active sheep allotment AUMs on there except Ensign Ranches, which is selling out. They have some private. They were offered $95,000 not to have sheep or goats on their private ground. Currently, they're working under a reciprocal agreement, which they're bound anyway. Okay, we just simply said, you haven't raised sheep in the past. Just so you don't, here, let us compensate you. Don't. There's $95,000. We also committed to $25,000 a year to go on water projects at a minimum and habitat projects for the next 5 years. And anybody that knows sheep knows that sportsmen's groups love them, and they continue to dump money into it, and it benefits everybody on that mountain. We also offered them a seat to come at the table to help us manage them. We've told them that if we have any issues with these sheep coming off the mountain, getting in a hobby farm or even a operation, kill them. Let's kill them. Done. We're willing to do whatever it takes to have sheep on the mountain, but we're not going to go through a NEPA. And depending upon the MOU, depending upon, you know, the devils are in the details as to whether we'd go there. I ask you tonight to vote on this. Accept the plan. We can work through some of these issues. We've done our due diligence. Quite honestly, we're being held hostage in the sense of guys trying in the livestock industry trying to get their AUMs back by holding us hostage. We, in effect, we can't. We support them. We wish they had all their AUMs back, but it's not our fault. It's not wildlife's fault. We're willing to stand with them, but they got to quit fighting against us. Thank you.
Thank you, Troy. It's a good thing we didn't talk about the three-minute thing, huh? All right. But we're ahead of schedule. It's not midnight yet, so we're all right. All right. Okay. Comment period is over. Come back to the for us for discussion. And I guess I'm going to just be blunt here. I'm going to make it real clear. We're not going to table this tonight. I think if we have problems with it, we need to vote against it. If we don't, we need to vote for it. So I think I don't think we have the right to table anything.
So that's my. And I think our input would not, if the Wildlife Board acted this meeting, us tabling it, they wouldn't know what our opinion was.
Right.
So I support a vote.
So anyway,
We can, but that's what, pardon me, I forgot your name, Justin stated, is we could vote to vote, we could vote against it, but we could also vote to table it so that it can come back.
The tabling doesn't come back to us. You know, we're going to tell the Wildlife Board we like it, we don't like it, or we didn't even want to vote on it because we didn't think that they've done their due diligence yet. And I don't think that's fair. I think we need to tell the Wildlife Board yay or nay.
I can agree with that.
And that's so. Okay. Oh, Tim.
I said I agree.
Okay.
Sorry, I called your name.
All right. Let's up for discussion. Let's talk about it. Where are we at?
Well, in my opinion, there is precedence of it being successful. As we've said,
we have had the sheep out here for, what, 30 years? Oak Creek was the last one, and I remember that was a heated, long discussion that we had in the rack, and it's been successful. So to me, it's a sound plan.
See, and staying up with these sheep units and mitigating these private landowner situations, we have one close to us where we fight the same battle, the division fights the same battle to sustain that resource. Them sheep range, they move when they reach population and have to relocate. And if they do get to the point of that, they mitigate that. We watched them do it with the Goslin herd when there was their own illnesses taking place, just so it wouldn't spread over to the Bear Top. I mean, the division has done an excellent job mitigating any of those issues, and it's been proven in history, and I don't see it deviating from that in the future.
Okay, I think we're still in talking to the folks on the ground, and they didn't indicate, and this letter doesn't indicate, that they have a problem with the DWR's mitigation plan.
So I missed the big red truck, because I'm way lost on what the concerns are then.
The primary concern is with the folks that I talked to, and it talks right here in the county's letter about how, you know, that they had reached an agreement or whatever with the DWR for that mitigation plan. So let me explain what happens with a wildlife species and a radical environmental group will come in, and what happens is, if they want, and they want sheep and cattle, domestic sheep and cattle, they want them off the range. That's no secret. I mean, they're plenty open about it. And so what they'll do is they'll come in and they'll sue if the BLM or Forest Service allows a grazing plan and the rancher agrees to it, and the BLM Forest Service agree to it, and they move forward on this grazing plan. And the environmental groups will come in and say, well, you did not consider what that grazing plan would do to moose habitat or bighorn sheep habitat. Therefore, you cannot move forward. Those grazers cannot move forward, and they'll get an injunction from a court to hinder or keep the stockmen from being able to use their range until the BLM or Forest Service mitigates their concern. And so the environmental groups are usually not suing the rancher directly. They're not suing the DWR directly. They're not suing Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife directly. They're suing on policy rule deals or whatever they can find, or if they don't feel like the Forest Service or BLM adequately addressed a wildlife species concern, they'll sue on that to keep the ranchers from operating. And a lot of their concerns are very trivial. No one else has them but them. Okay? And so that is where the concern lies. So that's the process they're using. And so, but the problem with that is the only people that can build in protections to keep the radical groups from doing that is the DWR. They're the only ones that can build in those MOUs and those protections to keep them from doing that. So the people I've talked to on the ground, I think there's a feeling in the comments that they're opposed to the species. I haven't talked to one yet that's opposed to the species. They're opposed to the other concerns that I think could be mitigated quite quickly. So that's the deal. Nobody attacked that I talked to the DWR's mitigation plan or their plan if the animal comes off, what they're going to do, or they didn't even really question that plan. They believe the DWR, if somebody calls and says, hey, we got an issue with a
with an animal, they will, I didn't hear anybody say they're not going to take care of it. They believe that they're going to take care of it.
I think one of the difficult things with this is if you build in, what you think will keep them from suing you in one way, they're going to find a different avenue. And so to hold something up until we find out every single way that we can prevent a radical group from suing, we would never get anything done.
No, and we're not trying to hold it up, and we know that it's not going to be litigation proof.
Right.
However, as Mr. Bushman stated, and my experience, this is pretty, they haven't challenged it yet. Okay, so...
It seems like maybe there's a different venue to work this out.
Yeah, there is. We would need a little more time to do that. I do want to address a few other issues. The native thing brought up. I wish that wouldn't have been brought up, because I don't really care. I guess I don't know who brought up whether it's a native species, not a native species. The thing is, I'm not native. You're not native. That's right, Tim.
I am.
So that's exactly my.
I am.
That's exactly. That's
those sheep mean a lot to us.
I agree.
You best watch what you say.
Well, no, that
actually he was going to say you're native.
That's my point. If we're going to do the native thing and base things on whether things were native or not, maybe they should be deciding. I mean,
and if you're going to leave it up to me to decide, they stay. They go over there.
Well, I agree. And that was my. You just made my point. I'm supporting. I mean, the native thing, non-native thing, it's antiquated. It's not a good argument either direction.
And okay. I'd be preferred to be called Native American.
Well, I was meaning the species, not individuals, but. The NEPA, I hate NEPAs. I think the reason that they're still pushing for the NEPAs is because they haven't been presented these other alternatives that could have been presented 2 months ago. I agree, there does not need to be a NEPA on this. We've got some stuff done on horses and stuff that everybody in the world said we was going to have to do a NEPA. Well, we find out there don't have to be a NEPA. So the NEPA thing, I think if they're presented the alternatives, the Cattlemen's Association, if they're presented alternatives that should have been presented before, the NEPA thing can go away. I hate being pigeonholed a little bit on how I'm going to vote, because at the last RAC meeting I voted in support of a proposal made by Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife on bighorn sheep, actually. My thing is I think I don't think this needs to be drug out. I agree with you guys. I've talked to the governor's public lands coordinating office today. They're willing, if we're willing, if the parties are willing, they will facilitate meetings in the next 30 days to address these issues, get them worked out. Work on some MOUs, get this back on the agenda quickly, and get it moved forward. The thing is, if we could, there's no reason not to do that. I think that would be quicker to do it that way on just the Mineral Mountain issue. It would be quicker to do it that way than to go through the sheep management program or management renewal that I know begins this month. I think we could separate this out, hurry and take care of this, and get moved forward on it. I'm in favor of bighorn sheep. I'd like to hunt them myself someday. I am not opposed to them. And the people I've talked to are not concerned about habitat. They're not concerned about habitat. I think there's a disconnect on what the real issue is and what's been presented, and I think that could be mitigated quickly. So I think we just need a little more time, but I think it needs to be said, this needs to come back by no later than July, August. I don't see no reason for it not to. And I think it could be. I think it could. It's actually an opportunity. I could see where it could be used. Wildlife could be used as litigation protection for stockmen if it's done right. Instead of the opposite that occurs now. So
my question is all these permits are valid right now, right? For the stakeholders.
Yes.
When they come for renewal, how often is that challenged?
Most of those come up every 10 years.
So.
But they don't all come up at once is the problem. So you'll have one permittee come up, and then, you know, it's not all 10-year interval. We look at all the permittees. They're just whenever they acquired that permit or whatever kind of sets the date on it. So I think we're very, very close on this plan. I really do. I don't think it's quite there. But I don't see no reason for it not to be there in a hurry. The thing is, we could spend 30 to 60 days now and prevent years of litigation later.
You know, keep in mind, you know, Rich, I know you're pretty passionate about this. Keep in mind, you can make a motion if you want to on something. So, I mean, that's... You know, that is an opportunity to let the Wildlife Board know that a certain step would be a good idea.
Right.
Okay. Other discussion?
I'd like to see it happen. I'd like to have these sheep go there. They are a native.
Mm-hmm. Other discussion? Well, I'll entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion. Do we accept the proposal as presented?
That was Daniel Davis made the motion to accept it as presented. Do I have a second?
No, thank you.
Tim Ignacio, second. Now discussion.
And then I would hate to see the ball that's already began to roll. You know, there is a meeting set up for what, the 27th, the 29th? Something that's already been set up. I would hate to see that ball that's already rolling that can potentially get the sheep out there and mitigate these issues both. I hate to see that opportunity lost.
So
the Wildlife Board isn't until, that'll give time.
It's May 31st.
But it's not till May 1st.
And I would like it on record that we are not concerned about working with the Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife or the DWR, and we'll push it to make sure it happens quickly.
Okay. All right, so we got a motion and a second. I'm not hearing any amendments. So all those in favor, raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Opposed? 1, 2. Motion passes. Good discussion.
Do we want to ask those two that are opposed why they were opposed, or are you okay with just taking that yourself to the Wildlife?
No, actually, I guess that would be a good idea. Dan, you want to tell us why you were opposed?
Sure, yeah. I mean, there's passion on both sides, obviously, and that's great. Just to me, it feels like, you know, there's enough concern that, I mean, the southern region tables this proposal, which tells me that they're not ready for this. I've heard enough concern here tonight that makes me feel like, you know, this isn't really ready. So that's why I voted against it.
Yep. You want to add anything there, Richie?
No, we've got to get on the right arguments and what our real concerns are. I mean, it's for some reason when I talked to what's her name with the Wool Growers Association, and I said, look, if we had some of these MOIs and told her what we'd look for in those MOI or MOUs, she said, well, why wasn't that presented to us? We didn't even know that was a possibility. I used the bison example in the booklets in the oil and gas industry and the MOU that's there. And she said, we didn't even know those was possibilities. And she liked the idea. They wanted the idea. So I opposed to it just because I think there's solutions that wasn't brought forward for whatever reasons, I don't care, that could quickly be brought forward, and we could kill two birds with one stone.
Yeah, I don't think this thing tonight stopped that from happening.
No,
I still think it could happen. It probably should happen.
Yes.
So
this is a statewide thing. This is just not with this particular unit. So it's something that needs to go on to for the entire state, is what I see.
I would hope, Justin, that maybe the you know what you've heard tonight, you'll kind of really encourage that meeting to happen and have all the players at the table. And
yeah, I'll certainly take this back to our leadership. And we do. We have that meeting at the end of the month on this MOU topic. And so, Richie, I appreciate your feedback. It's been good to understand that a little better. Thank you.
Thank you.
I've got a secretary that wants to take a 5-minute break. So let's re-adjourn here. Let's re-adjourn here at... I don't even know what time it is. When the big hands on the 8, whatever
the
that
hours is.
Is
enough.
that's only about 6 minutes, by the way.
Please don't take long. We've just got two quick things left.
Yeah, just get up. Get a little movement here after 3 hours.
Whoops, sorry.
What do you think?
Wow.
I said the big hand is on the 8. We're going to start again. All right. Let's. Next on the agenda is a proposed rule amendments to the conservation and sportsman permit. It is another action item. And we're going to turn the time to Kenny Johnson, our administrative services section chief.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kenny Johnson, Admin Services Chief from Salt Lake City. So we will be looking at three different rules and some proposed changes. They all left, but...
Yeah, all the good-looking ones left.
I appreciate Justin and...
Shannon, you owe me again.
It happens to me every time. It's fine. But no, I appreciate Justin and Dax and others who have already mentioned kind of the benefits of the conservation permit rule amendments, and the changes we're going to talk about tonight will be brief, and I'll try to get through them. So we're proposing to change and streamline some of the internal processes and reporting of expenditures for this program and as you'll see the Expo program. For those unfamiliar, Troy kind of mentioned before how it works. The Wildlife Board for the Conservation Permit Program sets aside a small percentage of permits that are then utilized in an auction format to generate revenue to fund conservation in Utah. The funds are divided up with 30% of the proceeds going direct to the division, 10% of the proceeds to the organization for use in overhead, and there's a significant amount of overhead with corral and all this stuff. And we'll talk a little bit about some electronic changes a little bit later. And then 60% retained by the organization to be spent on division-approved projects. And so the Wildlife Board asks us to find ways to report these positive effects and impacts in a more straightforward way, and we think these changes help us do that. So first off, we're proposing to strike an old provision and vague section rule that allowed the groups to propose an alternate way to distribute conservation permits. And our intent is just to clarify that they be distributed initially through an auction to the high bidder. We also want to clarify that there can only be one statewide conservation permit per species. And third, if we have more than one rifle season for the same species, so maybe deer or elk, the conservation permit holder must select a single season. They wouldn't automatically get both or multiple rifle seasons. Moving forward, we propose that all the interest earned on the 60% of the retained revenue be required for use on projects, that the conservation funds committed to approved projects be remitted sooner to the division, so within 60 days instead of 90 of being invoiced. And third, the retained revenue must be expended on approved projects or transferred to the division by September 1st, 2 years following when it was collected. And that's an important distinction. Right now we track it as committed and spent. This is one step further. This is actually spent and or transferred to the division. So these projects will be approved up front with a signed cover sheet. We'll invoice for the total to complete the project, collect the funds within that 60 days, and then the work will be scheduled and completed. These steps in the process will be entered in the division's database and will allow us to show these funds fully expended in the project details in our annual report to the Wildlife Board and that we share with the public. Moving on to some internal process updates with issuing and redeeming vouchers. We're developing some technology that will help us better track and issue vouchers electronically. This will prevent paper vouchers from being misplaced or delayed or need to be reprinted. The group must provide the name of the successful bidder, the winning bid amount, and the date of the event where the permit was auctioned within 10 days of the fundraising event, and the technology will facilitate that. If the successful bidder elects not to use a permit opportunity, they can designate it to another person. As long as the conservation group is notified, the winning bid amount is not decreased, and an affidavit is signed verifying they're not profiting from the assignment. And then if it's assigned to another person, the group would have 10 days to submit a complete voucher receipt to the division with the updated information. And then next, we propose to clarify our current practice that the division will not or cannot issue a conservation permit until the voucher information is received entirely. The recipient possesses a valid hunting or combination license. The permit fee is paid entirely, and someone from one of our front counters determines that the hunter is legally eligible to possess that permit. And so these provisions and the ones we just outlined would also apply to the special Antelope Island conservation permits. And then two final items on the conservation permit rule regarding season dates. We want to specify that in the definition section of this rule, a conservation permit for turkey is not valid for the three-day youth-only general season hunt, unless the hunter, the permit holder, qualifies as a youth. And then we propose changing the conservation bison permit season to run August 1st to January 31st, and that's just to be consistent with other once-in-a-lifetime bison opportunity. Okay, Next, we have our Expo permit rule amendments. For those not familiar with the Expo program, it's a contract awarded in five-year blocks with a renewal option for 5 years. There are two primary purposes. One is to generate revenue to fund wildlife conservation activities in Utah and attract a regional or national wildlife expo to Utah. As part of this program, the Wildlife Board authorizes up to 200 permits per year that are allocated to hunters through a drawing at the expo. An application handling fee of $5 is collected by the organizer. 30% of these funds are required to come back to the division to be spent on approved projects. And the remaining 70% may be used for administrative costs to help run the expo. The current organizer has committed the net proceeds to programs, projects, and personnel that support conservation initiatives in Utah. The majority of the amendments we'll see on the next couple of slides came about from the last time we awarded the contract. And then some of the billing and expenditure concepts that we talked about in conservation, we're going to just harmonize with this process as well, so they'll sound familiar as we go through those. Like all state agencies, when we contract with outside entities for services, we're required to follow state purchasing code. When the last contract was awarded, we worked to align the state law with the timeline in our rule. And they didn't overlap perfectly, but we absolutely followed the state procurement code. And so to remove any confusion, we're making it very clear that we follow the publicly noticed RFP process as outlined in the state purchasing code. These rule revisions will harmonize the Expo contract application and renewal process to be consistent with this code. And this will ensure that all interested qualified groups know the process up front and are considered through a standard formal procurement process. And then next, we would like to clarify that the division has authority to terminate the contract in interest of wildlife conservation, management issues, or compliance with law. And the third bullet there, each year we field more and more, it seems, complaints that some lucky individual drew multiple expo permits. And we want to specify moving forward that expo permit applicants be eligible to receive only one expo permit each year. When multiples are drawn, they would need to select a favorite permit within a couple days of being contacted by the division. Okay, did I miss a slide? There we go. So then, like the other one we talked about with conservation permits, we want to require that accrued interest on the application handling fee revenue that's dedicated to projects be used for projects. And then the same timeline, so application handling fee revenue committed to these projects be remitted to the division within 60 days of invoice instead of 90. And the application handling fee revenue for expo projects be expended or transferred to the division by August 1st, 2 years following the collection. So similar to what we've already talked about, this will allow us to zero these funds out annually. And then invoicing for these up front and putting them in the division database will replace the need for the expo contractor to provide us those redundant project details in their annual report. And the division will continue to report this detail in our annual audit presented to the Wildlife Board and to the public. So on to draw application procedures, and this one is really quick. We have just a couple of minor adjustments to this rule. We are proposing to copy the current rule, which outlines waiting periods in the expo rule, which is R657-55, into this draw application procedures rule. This is the current practice that is already spelled out in the expo rule and would essentially just move these types of permits into this one rule location. All other waiting periods apply, and there are no other changes for that piece. And lastly, we want to make just a couple of consistency changes. We want to standardize two minor proposed changes for here. We want to standardize the requirement across all of our draws for a hunter to possess a valid hunting or combination license in order to apply for sandhill crane, sharp-tailed grouse, greater sage grouse, and swan permits. And lastly, just ensure that group applications consisting of qualifying youth are considered for increased permit the increased percent of permits that are allocated to youth for turkey and those same species here, sandhill crane, sharp-tailed grouse, and greater sage grouse. So essentially, if you apply as a group of youth, you would get counted as a youth and have a better chance to draw. Thank you.
Thank you, Kenny. Can you go back to your first slide? Guess I had a couple of questions. I'm not. Oh, all right.
That one.
I'll go to the next one.
Was it on the conservation or the?
That was on the conservation. What was my question there? All right, the third bullet down. Retained revenue and accrued interest must be expended on approved budget or transferred to the division by September 1st, 2 years following the collection. How much funding are we talking about that is not getting spent within those 2 years?
It pretty much is all being spent within those 2 years, and we'll have a better idea after the snapshot of this next kind of budget audit cycle, but it's essentially all being committed right now and spent on projects.
So why do we need that? So that provision.
So this is just how it's always worked. So we just haven't had a lot of clarity on that on the reporting side. And we've added some oversight each year to just make this a little more obvious to report it up front.
So the rule's always been to require the funds be transferred to the division?
Not transferred. We've been reporting it as committed, which is you know, kind of projected to be used on projects. And now what we're going to do is just have them either spend it on the project or transfer it to the division to be used for projects. So it just tightens that up a little bit, but I think it's fair to say that those funds are primarily used, and then it gives us some flexibility if a project gets canceled or postponed or prolonged, we could credit them back that amount. And
yeah, I'd like that. It just doesn't feel good to be transferring funds to the, you know, that for some reason to me, it just doesn't feel very good. I guess I'd feel better about some other way of penalizing the organization for not doing it in the way of reduced permits next year or whatever, you know, that, you know, just to, so that incentive is there. You want that incentive there to get that work done. I just don't like the idea of transferring funds to the division. So
what the transfer does is it allows us to zero that balance out for sure, and we don't have to carry over a committed piece that kind of gets, it kind of loses some of its poignancy, I guess, is the reason we want to do that. This will make sure we can balance it out with and show those funds being fully expended on kind of a first in, first out basis, which is what the Wildlife Board has asked us to do.
Right, but they haven't been expended. They've just been moved to the division to spend, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So I'd make them spend it or reduce tags or something. So don't get mad at me, Troy. Can't, don't get mad at me. Anyway, it just doesn't feel good. All right, I had a couple other, because go to the next slide. I had a couple other questions, and I can't remember what they were. Oh, the second bullet down there. So basically, if I get a permit, if I buy a permit at a conservation, if I buy a conservation permit, I can give it to somebody else, transfer it to somebody else that I want to. I just can't sell it to them.
Correct. As long as the group knows about it, and then, yeah, you follow the process outlined here.
That's what that one's telling me right there.
Yep.
Okay.
You can sell it for what you paid for it. You just can't make a profit.
Right. Okay.
Is that right? Yeah, you can sell it just for not more than you paid.
Oh, okay. I guess that would be, yeah, I guess so. I think that's all I have for now.
Thank you.
Another question by the rec. Questions by the public? All right. We have two cards on this particular topic. So, Kevin, and then Ken, and maybe some more. Thank you.
I feel like I've spent more time up here than Troy tonight. First, I want to thank Justin for his presentation tonight on the conservation permit funds. Having recently been more involved with SFW, I've been able to see the effects of this program, and to be quite honest, it's mind-blowing what gets done in the state with these funds. If any avid sportsman could throw rocks at this program, I don't know how they could do it, because it's done more for this state, more for wildlife. Yes, sportsmen have to sacrifice a little bit, but it pays its dividends. It's an amazing program that I support. I'm grateful that I've been able to see the successes of it. I just wish the division, all the sportsmen's groups, including SFW, would do a better job at getting out to the public what is being done with these funds, because it is pretty dang amazing. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Ken, you're up, and after you will be Greg Bird.
Ken Powell, chapter chairman. Oh, sorry, I got a cold. For the Mule Deer Foundation, I've been the chapter chairman for 13 years here in Uinta Basin, putting on our banquet. We are very thankful we can participate in conservation permits at our local banquet. I have personally seen, just from the permitting, from the conservation permits, right at $1 million in the 13 years I've been doing it, just from Vernal, the Uinta Basin. We have put over $140,000 a year on the ground for conservation. So that adds up to well more than that since I've been doing this. But we support the division's proposal as recommended. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Greg, and then Troy.
Greg Bird, Utah-Wild Sheep. We support the amendment proposal as presented, and we just want to state that we're grateful to be part of this program. It is an amazing program. The division has done amazing things with this conservation program, and they are second to none in this country. Things that happen in this state just don't happen everywhere. It's just from the sheep standpoint, it's allowed us to be the most progressive state in sheep management and reintroduction to areas that have, it's just other states don't have the money to do it. And through these programs, we are just very blessed that we can do this stuff. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate you being here tonight. Troy.
Troy Justinson, Sports and Fish and Wildlife. I've got to admit one thing. This round of racks has not been fun. And I'm being that honest. It's not fun to have a slugfest with your brother. And it's not been fun. Yeah, but I do appreciate you sitting and listening and putting up with my passion, desire, and hopefully that, you know, someday that us and the livestock industry can come together and stand together unified. But when that, I know that day will come, but thank you. As far as conservation permits go and the expo permits, truly a unique opportunity to participate in. I'm grateful for that. I think one thing that's missed in this is a lot of credit comes to us as organizations. Really where the credit needs to go is the sportsman. These are tags that you and I and the average Joe gives up the opportunity to draw in hopes that we can generate enough money to generate and produce more opportunity and protect the habitat and the animals we love and preserve. I think that's only obvious by what Justin showed there. You know, $181 million, holy cow. But the neat thing about there is 1.5 million acres. If any of you have attended an SFW banquet, you've heard John Baer tout that. That is more acreage than all the rest of the United States combined. Hats off to Utah. That's amazing that we have a program here within the state that we thought of a way to fund that has manipulated and treated more acreage than the rest of the United States combined. Hats off to the agencies that work with us, the BLM, the Forest Service. This is a neat project. Related to the expo, this year we had a great expo. Over 50,000 people attended. Roughly about 15,000 participated in the $5 app This is a little different than conservation permit money in the sense that we're not selling a permit. We're collecting an application fee no different than Fallon, Nevada. But the big difference between Fallon, Nevada and what we do at the Expo is that money spent here in Utah put back to wildlife. This year alone, from that $5 app, SFW will commit close to $530,000 back on the ground. Different than the conservation permit also, it does not have to go into big game. This allows us to fund upland game projects, waterfowl projects, and other things. I think with what we contributed to waterfowl this year, we almost tripled their normal budget through the division. This is a great thing. We're thankful to be part of it. I'd like to thank the sportsmen of Utah for allowing us to participate. Thank you.
Thanks, Troy. Appreciate you being here tonight, too. All right, that was the last comment we had. Let's go to the discussion.
Randy, you had a question come up. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Okay. On these conservation tags, if a group... Can any group apply for these so long as they commit those revenues to habitat projects?
Yeah, that's a fair question. They have to meet some minimum requirements. They have to be a 501c3 recognized by the federal tax code as a charitable organization, and then they have to have a wildlife conservation mission to protect wildlife.
Thank you.
Other questions or discussion?
I got one question. So a lot of these clarifications, did any of these time frames change from what they were before, like the 60-day to 90-day? Does that impose more infractions or time committed to a process on behalf of these organizations to have to spend more time or drive more effort to get that to the division?
I don't think so. I think it streamlines it a little bit so we can report it a little more clearly. But the invoicing and the billing and the database end of it, it should actually help us be a little more efficient with that moving forward.
Because anybody that's spent time on a committee or a organization or anything else like that pro bono, trying to just do your time and follow those, there's a lot of animosity for some of that funding having to pay people to commit to that. But they've never been in the shoes where 100% nonprofit, I do this for nothing. They last 1 or 2 years dismal. They have a job they have to maintain. I think it's come a long ways to see where these jobs focus to our desires as sportsmen and the state and wildlife. So the program's amazing. The organizations involved have done it's uncomparable to anything else. I think it's a great program.
Thank you, Daniel. Other discussion? Comments? Well, we'll entertain a motion.
Yeah, I'll make a motion, Mr. Chair. Make a motion that we go ahead and accept the division's proposal as it's been presented here tonight.
That was Dan Abeda. Made that motion to accept the as presented tonight. Do I have a second?
I'll second that motion.
That was Brett. Second that motion. Any further discussion? All in favor? Unanimous. 8-0. Very good. Thank you, Kenny. Marty, you're the last one here tonight.
In for a wild ride here. We got five rules that are being changed. It's not going to be very exciting, but it'll be quick.
So is this an informative or an action item?
No, this is an action.
Okay.
Action item. So what we have is five different rules we'd like to amend. Each one of them is doing essentially the same thing. It's eliminating a committee that's created in rule and transferring those responsibilities to the division internally. And I'll give you a little bit of background on why we're doing that. Is this past year, Department of Natural Resources came under some scrutiny by the news media regarding their compliance with the Open and Public Meeting Act. It was not the division or any of its boards or councils that were critiqued, but it was some other agencies within the division. And it caused the division also to maybe reassess all of the various committees and working groups and things they have within their organizational structure to determine whether we are in compliance with the Open and Meetings Act there. And what we found is there was four different committees that are in five rules, but four committees that are created by rule and by that fact alone were arguably public bodies and had to be, you know, subject to the Open and Public Meeting Act. And these committees were not really designed for that type of function. They all deal with individualized issues, people that have agreements with the division, somebody that couldn't use a permit, and whether we could grant some remedial relief to them. And really not set up, they're not policy boards or, you know, public type issues that are more suitable for open and public meetings. And so for that reason, we're proposing that these committees simply kind of be eliminated and then the responsibilities given to the division, and avoid that potential possibility that we'd have to have, you know, go through notice requirements and agendas and minutes and recordings and posting everything on the public notice website. Not that it's secret, just not the types of things that are usually a public matter. So what we have quick is this. I'll go through these rules, and you can look at them. I won't read them all because I'll go through it in just a second, a little more detail. In the red font is the committees. So all of those will come up right here, and I'll tell you a little bit. So the Certification Review Committee operates under two different rules. One is the Amphibians, Reptiles, Possession, Importation, Transportation Rule. The other is the Transportation, Possession, Importation of all other animals other than reptiles and amphibians. And within that rule is created the Certification Review Committee. It's staffed by representatives from DWR, from the Department of Agriculture, and Department of Health. Committee makes recommendations to the Wildlife Board on petitions to reclassify species, which determine whether you can possess them or, you know, take them. The other is variance requests for prohibited species, and those are species that you can't possess that you have to ask the board for a variance, and they'll hear those requests and make recommendations to the board. And then lastly, appeals to the COR denials. So what we're proposing is that these responsibilities would be assumed by the division and exercised in consultation with the Department of Agriculture and Food and the Department of Health. The same people will all be involved. It's just going to be handled internally instead of a committee created by rule. The Air Committee operates under Chapter 50 under our air rule, and it's staffed solely by DWR representatives. The committee makes recommendations to the division director on complaints that are seeking some form of relief from the division due to errors in the processing and issuing of wildlife documents. So those are going to be your licenses and permits and certificates of registration. Those responsibilities held by that committee would be assumed by the division and handled the same way. The Walk-In Access Advisory Committee is a committee that operates under our Chapter 56 rule dealing with walk-in access and public access. It's staffed by representatives from DWR, sportsman interests, and agriculture interests and elected officials. The committee makes recommendations to the division director on complaints concerning the fair and equitable treatment of people participating in the walk-in access program. That committee, aside, has never organized or met. And so another reason that perhaps it's not all that necessary right now. And so we would propose that the responsibilities of that committee be assumed by the division. The Variance Committee operates under Chapter 57 dealing with our variance rule. It's staffed solely by DWR representatives. And the committee makes recommendations to the director on remedial relief sought by people who are substantially precluded from obtaining or using a wildlife document because of some event or condition in their life that's beyond their control, typically medical issues. We can try to help them out, whether it's restoring bonus points, waiving waiting periods, or in some instances, even granting season extensions. responsibilities of that group would be assumed by the division. And that concludes the five rules we're proposing for amendment.
Thank you, Marty. Questions, Brother Rack? Ken, have you any questions? You're the only public here. Who's left? All right.
So,
you got a question, Daniel?
So, although these committees would be assembled or resume responsibility by the division, would there still be direction and any type of outside involvement with, say, I mean, recommendations? Primarily walk-in access. I mean, there's.
No, we're not going to eliminate the function of what was the committee. We're just going to have it, the division internally organize the group of people to deal with those issues should the need arise. And the whole reason is one of the requirements to be a public body, which is a term used to define a group that has to comply with our Open and Public Meetings Act, is that they are created in statute, rule, or ordinance. And this is just an instance where we had some groups that, because of that one fact alone, they were arguably subject to the act, that we just didn't feel they were really well suited for it. And so we're just trying to take away that one criteria that would arguably make them subject to agenda, well, minutes. And not that they don't keep minutes, but just the formal process we go through for these RAC meetings. It's expensive, it's time consuming, and it's not well suited for these three or these five groups.
Other questions? No comments? Anybody have any heartburn with any of these? I'll entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion, Mr. Chairman, that we accept the presentation as presented.
That was Daniel Davis made a motion to accept the presentation as presented. Do I have a second?
I'll second that.
Richie Anderson made that second. Any discussion? All those in favor, raise your hand. 8-0 unanimous.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marty. You're not traveling home tonight, are you?
No.
Good. All right. That was our last action item. Do I have a motion to adjourn? Andrea?
Motion.
Oh. All right. Tim? Tim, make a motion to adjourn?
And Becky probably wants to.
I'll second the motion.
All right. Rebecca, second. All in favor? Is it unanimous?
Getting carried away down
yes.
there.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you all
Thank
for
you.
Coming tonight. Appreciate it.
It's been a long day.
See y'all.
We are adjourned.